Vader Star Wars The Empire Strikes Back Collection. Millennium Falcon that you put together. Batteries not included.
Nice landing, Han Solo. Uh-oh, come on, Chewbacca. Stormtroopers are coming.
Action figures each sold separately.
Got them on radar. I'll fire the laser cannon.
There's even a hidden storage hatch.
Ready for takeoff. Jump to light speed. We're gone. On to the Death Star.
Millennium Falcon from Kenner's Star Wars The Empire Strikes Back Collection. Action figures each sold separately.
Channel F, the one with all the fun. The Fairchild Video Entertainment System at your larger JCPenney. The home entertainment system that never gets old. Plug in a new video card and change the fun. Play tic-tac-toe, shooting gallery, or just doodle. Switch video cards and play Desert Fox. Switch again, it's blackjack. Or play the two built-in games, pro hockey or tennis champ. Channel F for fun. The Fairchild Video Entertainment System. Just $169.95. Video card cartridges, $19.95 each. At your larger JCPenney.
All the tools will be mine! Never thrown down! The Joes attack with battlecopters and air commandos that really fly! The Cobra counterattacks, so the Joes unleash ninja force with real ninja action! The Storm Shadow, Nunchuk, and Shepang! But Cobras get slice and dice! Joe and Cobra ninja force, battlecopters and air commandos, sold separately!
Cobra's fist!
No! We've only just begun!
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey.
How's it going?
All right, how are you doing?
Pretty good. So, check this out. I'm a professional now, right? Welcome to Geek Brunch Retrocast, Episode 2.
There you go. What's your name?
I am the leader of the Harrys. Chris Ivey.
There you go. That was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And I'm Mike. I'm Jimmy Olsen.
There you go. Badass Jimmy Olsen.
Yeah, badass. Punk ass. I don't know. He's Superman. For being Superman's pal, he doesn't treat him very well.
No.
But I guess it goes both ways.
Yep. And that might be a clue as to one of the things we're going to talk about today, which is the beginning of Kirby's Fourth World Saga.
Yes. Daryl might join in on us for a little bit.
Oh, cool.
From DC Noise.
Mm-hmm. Daryl Taylor.
This is a good idea because I haven't read these in forever.
Yeah. Well, I've been meaning to read them. And like I said in the message I sent to you, I picked up the first two Omnibi. And you know, I'm definitely going to be getting the fourth one. Hasn't come out in trade paperback yet, but it comes out next month sometime. Originally, these came out in hardcover, and I was going to get them that way. But the first one, at least, maybe the second one, are a little hard to find for regular price because they've gone out of print already. So, but yeah, knowing anybody that's listened to either of your shows or interacted with you on Twitter or anything like that knows you're a huge Kirby fan. And I thought it'd be really cool to get a chance to, I guess we're going to probably go through the whole Fourth World Saga, if that sounds cool to you, do like two or three issues of recording, because I think it'd be kind of cool to get, as I read through these, get, you know, your thoughts as such a long-term Kirby fan. It'd be really cool to get those on recording.
Yeah, I'm loving it. This was a great idea because I have all of them in hardcover. I not only have the Kirby Fourth World Omnibus, I have the Commandy, I've got the Newsboy Legion, the Challenges of the Unknown Kirby. So it's like, yeah, this is great. And I don't know how the paper quality is for the trade paperback, but the paper quality for the hardcover is awesome because it's almost like just a thicker newsprint, and it just comes across really good. It makes the art pop.
Yeah, I think it might be the same paper that they used. And in fact, they actually, I thought it was kind of amusing that they didn't even change the back cover blurb. It still says hardcover.
Oh.
That's the first of four hardcover volumes. They didn't even bother with that. But yeah, it's a pretty nice volume. Definitely good quality reprints and stuff. And I think they did some touch up to the color, maybe, as well when they were setting this up. But one of the cool things I really like about it is the fact that it's in chronological order, because I'm such a nerd when it comes to things like that.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess we tackle the first three, which are all Jimmy Olsen.
Yeah.
And then it jumps around.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess we could jump right into talking about those if you want. I was just going to really quick thank everybody that checked out the first episode. It was really cool getting some, especially even some really immediate feedback. But, you know, Alan and Keith, Rock, Eric on Twitter. We got some, you got some messages on Facebook from Savage Chuck and William.
Yeah.
And Chuck and Ryan from Star Joes both said that they're going to check it out when they got a chance to. So especially as someone that's new to podcasting, it's really awesome to get some immediate feedback, and really appreciate people checking out the first episode. So hopefully people continue to enjoy what we're doing here. First episode was an awesome time for me to record. I've been looking forward to doing this again since we finished last time. So
yeah, it was a lot of fun. And not only is this retro stuff helping me work my backlog and stuff, but I'm enjoying the hell out of it. Plus, it's helping me take a break from the current stuff, so when I go back to the current stuff, it's more fresh than like if I was just to read current stuff.
Yeah.
So it puts things, a lot of things, in perspective. So I'm enjoying it a lot more.
Yeah, it is kind of neat to switch back and forth between old and current stuff, and see, you end up seeing some parallels, and you end up also being, it's easy to get caught up in, you know, I notice a lot of stuff that's talked about on the internet and things that people complain about or discuss. It's interesting how many of those issues are things that have been a part of comic books for decades. You know, and it's easy to get caught up and think that this such and such an issue or such and such a problem or concern is a new thing, but there's a lot of stuff that's always for decades now been a part of comic book fandom. People just didn't have the internet to express it.
Yeah, they'd have to take the time to write something.
Yeah.
Type something and then mail it and pay postage.
So it took a lot of work, but people definitely did it.
And it's not as immediate. Like,
right.
In Twitter, you could tweet right now, and then mm-hmm. you'd wait weeks to maybe get some feedback.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there were people that hated things, and they were vocal about it. You know, why are you changing this creative team? What the hell's going on? And I don't remember how this was received at the time,
mm-hmm.
but I could imagine it, some people loving it and some people hating it. Because I don't know how you, I'll be real interested to think what you think of this, but I thought this really stood the test of time as far as concept and ideas and stuff. It's just awesome.
Yeah, definitely.
It's like larger than life, and it, so much happens per issue that, and when you realize what's happening per issue, is like you're getting introduced to characters for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Like Flippa Dippa.
Yeah.
This first appearance shows up in this issue. Whereas mm-hmm. the Newsboy Legion, this is kind of like their first Silver Age appearance. But, you know, Simon right. and Kirby created them, you know, back in the 40s. So this was, you know, it's probably a creation he was real passionate about. And then he just made them the kids of the old Newsboy Legion.
Right, yeah. So there's, well, both make an appearance in these three issues, but the main Newsboy Legion we get is their kids. And then we also get a grown-up version of the 40s Newsboy Legion make an appearance in these stories too.
What else is really powerful about this is Morgan Edge, because he was also introduced in this, and he's a big player in the DC universe.
Mm-hmm.
And you see right off the bat his link to, you know, the dark side.
Right. So, yeah.
And the other thing I found extremely interesting that even plays into the New 52 is Superman early on. I think they realized early on that things were changing from newspaper to TV at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, this is the time frame when they were working for Global, you know, Communications, which was a broadcast, or Galaxy Broadcasting.
Yeah, Galaxy.
A television company, which, you know, they're moving away from the Daily Planet. It was still owned by, you know, Galaxy owned Daily Planet, but these guys were actually moving into TV.
Yeah, and Morgan Edge being he was the president of Galaxy Broadcasting System that bought out the Daily Planet.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of like little herrings in this book that you could get enjoyment of if you're reading the New 52. Even though things are quite different, there's a lot that's still the same. Like Lois is now, you know, doing broadcasting, and Superman or Clark recently said, screw this. He actually went to Morgan Edge in the latest Superman issue and said, you know, I'm tired of all your gossip, and, you know, you guys aren't really a reporting news publication. And I kind of gave his speech and got fired. So
yeah,
it there's a lot that's here even for the current. And then if you were into Final Crisis, you can see where Grant Morrison picked pieces of this and dropped it into his interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this was very... Actually, Grant Morrison writes the introduction to this volume one of the fourth World Omnibus. I didn't read it yet. I tend to skip those and read them after I'm done reading the actual comics, case it, just so it doesn't influence my own opinion as I'm reading. But he's definitely very, very influenced by, especially this period of Kirby, it seems.
Well, one thing that you'll learn in that article that is interesting is he's really influenced by what Kirby did. Like, he was kind of blown away by what he did, but he just recently discovered it. So it just goes to show, you know, he didn't grow up as a kid reading this stuff.
Yeah. So
that was interesting. And the other thing that's fascinating about this is it's all Jack Kirby. I mean, this is not somebody else writing or doing stuff. This is written and drawn by Jack Kirby. All the ideas are Jack Kirby, and inked by Vince Coletta. Vince Coletta gets a lot of shit, but I didn't really see anything bad in this, you know, as far as inking.
Yeah, I think I've come across comments here and there. It's people have complained at times that his inks in spots didn't do justice to Kirby's pencils. Is that the gist of it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I definitely could see Kirby in here.
Oh, yeah. If anything, there might be a panel here or there throughout the issues where the characters' faces look a little off or funny compared to what you'd normally expect a Kirby face to look like. So maybe there's a spot here and there that maybe, you know, and this is just my guess based on having heard those opinions about Coletta's inks expressed, but wasn't really anything that jumped out at me. And I definitely feel, I mean, the excitement of, if you're into Kirby's style of art, it definitely comes through.
There's also the other thing that blew me away that I didn't remember at the time, or I totally forgot, was that photorealistic trip.
Yeah.
Where it has like two pages of like them traveling and these photos like mesh together of it looks like a race car instead of the war wagon, right? Or the whiz wagon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's very unusual.
Yeah, they're almost, it goes black and white, and they're almost It's like almost like a psychedelic trip.
Yeah.
That they end up in. Yeah, one thing I did, so this is, to be specific, these three issues are Superman Pale, Jimmy Olsen 133, 134, and 135. And one of the things I really found fascinating was, so it was a big deal. Kirby left Marvel after, what would you say, a decade or a little less than a decade or something at this point?
Seems more than that, but it yeah. sounds like he created, you know, like, was it 63 when everything took off?
Yeah.
It was about a decade. Yeah. It just seems longer because of how many issues of FF he did, you know?
Yeah, they accomplished a lot, yeah.
he accomplished so much in such a short amount of time. That's another thing that's amazing about what he did. Because you're right, it is less than a decade because this is 1970. Yeah.
And I think one of the last things that he did at Marvel was Thor, right? Before going over?
Yeah.
I was curious because of the way that, you know, they promoted a lot of these early issues that he did for DC. You have Kirby's here. That was their big promotion and on the covers. And so I was kind of curious about the way that he came in and started with these three issues in an established title, because, you know, the other three titles that are a part of the Fourth World Saga all started with number ones. The Forever People, New Gods, and Mr. Miracle. So I think it's almost kind of in your working throughout this, Kirby creates a lot of new characters that have gone on to be a big part of the DC universe. But I found it kind of interesting how it's almost as if, in a way, these crazy concepts, this whole Fourth World Saga kind of creeps in through an established title. Because if you think, trying to imagine how it was at the time, if you picked up issue number 133 of Jimmy Olsen, it wouldn't be for another, you know, 3 months before the actual number one started coming out. So I was wondering, you know, well, what was issue 132 like, the one right before this, you know, to kind of get an idea of how jarring it might have been all of a sudden. Because, and so issue 132 had two stories in it, and I think it probably was pretty jarring because the main story was written by Leo Dorfman. And it seems like at that point he was pretty synonymous with Superman. Since 58, he'd been writing all kinds of different Superman titles, including Jimmy Olsen. So, you know, I have to think that, and the person that drew that story was Murphy Anderson. So I have to think that that suggests that things were pretty status quo the month before, and what you got, without actually looking at the issue myself and reading the story.
I read a lot of Superman's girlfriend Lois Lane and Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, and mm-hmm. a lot of them were kind of like one shot day in the life of where Superman was there, but he was really a secondary character to you know, what Jimmy Olsen's adventure was, or Lois's. Lois was always trying to hook up with Superman. But and always there was a lot of jealousy going back and forth, but they were kind of like drama, soap opera yeah. type drama stories. And then you enter into this story, which really is, man, there's just so much that happens in these issues that you can see a lot of seeds being planted for everything mm-hmm. to come. And if you're aware of the New Gods, and if you're aware of Darkseid and stuff, like, Darkseid appears in these issues, and, man, he only appears for, like, one panel in the yep. second issue. And it's just yep. one panel, and that's it. It's kind of like the Venom appearance when he appeared in Spider-Man. You know, you want the first appearance or the Wolverine first appearance. It's just like, bam, and then you get the first full appearance in the next issue. Or Starkseid's still really minor in all these three issues, whereas he plays a major character later on.
Yeah, I would say he's very much in the background, you know. You understand that he's behind a lot of what's going on, but you don't get a full sense of how important, you know, he'll become. But, you know, reading it nowadays, you know how big that character's become and how often he's been used, you know, in other stories.
Mm-hmm. So I thought we'd talk a little bit about, the premise of the first story, which is... I think the Newsboy Legion play a really big part in the first story because Mork and Edge kind of hires them to take Jimmy and also build this. He funded this Whiz Wagon, which is this cool little vehicle that can get them places relatively fast and do just about everything. It could go in the water. It could, you know, go in 90 degrees up.
Yeah.
It can do crazy ass shit. And, I think it's mostly developed by Big Words, who's kind of like the scientist of them. And then you got Tommy Tompkins, who I at this point I don't really know a lot about him because it seems like they focus on Big Words, Gabby, and Scrapper. Gabby's always got the funny lingo going on, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And on the very first page of issue 133, it cracked me up. I was reading everything that he said out loud because it just...
Oh, I did it. I did the same thing because you actually try to do the accent too.
Yeah, I wrote down the first thing he says is pretty much the first thing that you read in the issue as Jimmy Olsen is coming into where the Newsboy Legion is working on the Whiz Wagon. He says, "Come on inside, Olsen. Don't be a snob. This place won't bite you." And he pretty much talks like that all the time. It's hilarious.
And as I read some of these characters, I'm thinking, man, some of these characters might have been like Kirby and his buddies back in the day. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I heard Kirby was a real scrapper, so I'm thinking he's like his personality's in Scrapper.
Probably.
He was kind of like a tough badass.
Yeah.
And real quiet. And then Flippa Dippa, they introduced, which had a really goofy name at the time.
Yeah.
But it was one of the ways they introduced a black character, which I don't think they had too many back in this day. But his thing is he was like their underwater support. Like, that was his specialty. If he always wore a scuba suit, too.
Yeah, no matter what,
no
even
matter
when
what.
They're on land.
Yeah. He was their Aquaman.
Yeah. Yeah, and I didn't realize it when I was reading it, but when I went and did a little research on it, that's when I found out that he's actually new. That he wasn't, like, he didn't have a predecessor. Kirby gives him a predecessor when the old Newsboys show up later on, but as far as the 1940s Newsboy, it was just the four guys.
Yeah. So that was amazing. So you get Morgan Edge in there saying he wants to send, you know, Jimmy and them to go find what is this? Well, I don't know if it's necessarily the Mountain of Judgment. Is that what he's sending them into early, or is it for the habitat or the wild area?
Well, we find out that he's sending them to check out the wild area. Later on, it seems like Jimmy knows that he's looking for the Mountain of Judgment, but we don't really find that out until later in the issue when he explains it to Superman, I think.
Right, and the wild area is a pretty badass. It seems very like hippie, but at the same time, you don't see anybody slacking around. Do you know what I mean? It's like a well-formed society where they kind of built their world in the trees. Mm-hmm. Like you could see the housing and the technology and all that stuff in the trees. And they have, like, all these badass weapons, and you wonder where they came from, and you find out later where they came from.
Yeah.
But their weapons are pretty damn powerful, because they almost, like, make Superman a joke sometimes. And Mm-hmm. It's like, we just need to knock him out. Just hit him with the Krypton gun.
Yep. Yeah, so when they get to the wild area, they're immediately... So this wild area, it's like an island, I guess, and they're immediately attacked by a motorcycle gang, which is not necessarily what you expect to find on an island, but basically Olsen and the Newsboy Legion end up in a fight with the motorcycle gang right away.
Mm-hmm. And they take out the leaders.
Yeah, the leader, he kind of looks like Dr. Doom. He's called Iron Mask. Since Olsen ends up beating him, the motorcycle gang, which they're called the Outsiders, which this would be before Batman had a team called the Outsiders, he becomes the new leader of the Outsiders because that's the rule, basically. Like, if you beat the leader, you become the current leader.
Yeah, I dug that. And I dug this one leader of the Outsiders. I forget what was his name? He takes out Superman like he's nothing.
Oh, he's kind of like the right-hand man.
Pulls out the gun, yeah.
Yeah, I think it starts with a Z. I'm looking here. Yango.
Yeah. He's one of the only ones that they really name.
Yeah.
They keep mentioning him. He's like he's like Jimmy Olsen's. He does all the work. Jimmy Olsen just commands.
Yeah.
And so, Morgan Edge has this like plan. You know, mm-hmm. that's his whole plan is to go explore this area and you'll see what the reasons why later on. But he also wants to keep Clark away. So what interestingly he does is he tries to hit him with have him taken out, right?
Yeah. It's basically the first appearance of the Intergang, because it's members of the Intergang that go to try to run Clark Kent over, not knowing that he's Superman and invulnerable.
They actually do it.
Yeah.
In front of a bunch of witnesses, it's like, bam!
You're right, yeah, that are amazed that he gets up and walks away. But yeah, I mean, basically, you know, Clark Kent, Superman, he's suspicious because he doesn't understand. He's not happy about Morgan Edge and Galaxy Broadcasting System owning the Daily Planet. And he's suspicious as to Morgan Edge, why he would, it seems like a pretty important assignment, why he would send someone as young as Jimmy Olsen, not, you know, him or a more experienced reporter. So that's why he heads out there as Superman. And he kind of... I definitely got the feeling that he's sort of the adult figure throughout this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you said, that they're kind of hippie-ish, and I think Superman so he's surprised as he goes through, and you mentioned their city. It's basically, it's a really cool splash page of a place called The Habitat, and it's basically like Kirby technology, but everything's made out of wood. And Superman himself is pretty surprised by it and calls him a dropout society. I like that kind of colloquial 70s term, you know, for hippies and stuff.
Yeah, it could be where the Ewok village came out of.
Yeah.
Except it's even more sophisticated because it seems like they have highways built out of tree bark.
Yeah. Yeah, it really looks like it should be made out of metal, but it's just wood grain instead. So yeah, like you said, Superman gets taken out pretty often because they have weapons that shoot Krypton gas. One of the other notes that I made about this issue was, I love when so Olsen's pretty high on his horse about being the leader of the Outsiders, and he's very determined to follow through on this mission or this assignment that Morgan Edge gave him. And Superman's recovering with the Newsboy Legion from being knocked out. And when Olsen comes in, and this is when we find out more about their assignment, Superman says, "Well, well, if it isn't young Attila the Hun and his barbarian horde," to Olsen. So I thought that was pretty, because throughout these issues, Superman's pretty pissed at Jimmy Olsen. So I kind of thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, well, he keeps blasting him.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not on really good terms.
But Superman knows a lot, and he kind of keeps like, you'll see in later issues that he knows kind of what's going on, and he's being a jackass. Well, it appears as he's being one in the first issue, but because he knows more that's going on, but he doesn't take any time to explain it to anybody else what is going on.
Yeah, I definitely thought at first he sort of seems like he's the old-fashioned fuddy-duddy, you know, being super cautious, but Kirby kind of turns that on its head later on. You find out that it's because he is experienced as a superhero. He knows a lot more than he's, like you said, than he's letting on. So that kind of, basically this issue ends with Olsen telling Superman that what they're really supposed to do is find out what this thing called the Mountain of Judgment is, and that there's this strange passage called the Zoom Way that they have to use to get there, and the outsiders all seem pretty reverent and fearful of this Zoom Way, and that kind of takes us into the next issue.
Yeah, because people have died going through that, or they've gone into the Zoom Way and then they've never heard back from them.
Yeah.
If this is your first Jimmy Olsen book, you might question, you know, like, why are they even pals?
Yeah.
Because they don't quite act like it to each other. Yeah. and it's interesting enough on the cover of 134, which 134 is a great issue if you want to get first appearances of character. Well, all of these are, because you could grab, you know, the first issue is the first appearance of Morgan Edge and Flippa Dippa and, you know, Inner Gang, you know, mentioned. So you're getting a lot of key appearances. I think it's the first appearance of the Whiz Wagon too. So there's a lot going on there. And then the second issue's really big as far as, you know, one of the biggest villains in DC. It's his first appearance.
Yep. Yeah, I guess the only other thing I wrote down about this first issue is just that mentioning the Whiz Wagon, you know, that's your awesome double-page splash that you get from Kirby this issue. Right at the beginning is a big double-page splash of the Whiz Wagon, which is just awesome.
Yeah, I don't know how they all fit in there. Well, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, I guess that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's an interesting contraption. And then when you're looking at some of these motorcycles, they're also very interesting. Very futuristic. You can see where the Forever People vehicle is coming from.
Yeah.
As the design.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's right. It's kind of similar. So you want to jump into 135?
Yeah.
Or 134?
Mountain of Judgment. Yep. That's such a cool name. And then when you find out what the Mountain of Judgment is, it's pretty damn awesome.
Yeah, I definitely didn't see it coming. I didn't know what it was going to be.
The interesting thing in here, though, I wanted to point out before we get into it is...
Sure.
He's actually... Is it Gabby or is it Scrapper? Scrapper? I can't remember.
Which?
That's filming it. He's got the GBS camera filming all of this, so Morgan Edge can see everything that goes on.
Yep.
Got a little tone important. Of Speed Racer in here.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that was another good sequence for Scrapper's dialogue when he's starting up the camera and he can't see anything out of it and turns out to be like Gabby's bending down in front of it, doing something, so he's like his ass is in the way.
Blow the scene, Gabby. You're blocking me camera lens.
But yeah, I mean, it pretty much picks up where the previous issue left off. The Jimmy and the Outsiders and the Newsboy Legion, they're all preparing to go travel the Zoom Way to find this Mountain of Judgment, and Superman's there, you know, acting the adult and telling them, you know, warning them and trying to stop them, and they pretty much just take him out again with the kryptonite gas.
Yeah, before that, they said, let's run over him again.
Yeah, the outsiders especially aren't too, they're not too sympathetic to Superman.
Just run him over again. So he's already been run over twice.
Yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think the first time they shot him and knocked him out, it wasn't even Jimmy that, like, Jimmy didn't command him or anything. They just went ahead and shot him with the gas. So, yeah, I mean, basically, I mean, a lot of the issue, which is this really awesome sequence of events as they travel the Zoomway, I thought it really, you know, it's talked up a lot before they travel it, and I thought that it really got across because they have to go through a lot of different obstacles. It starts off, they look like they're going to crash right into a mountain. Instead, it's a fake facade that they drive
through. How does Jimmy know that?
I don't know.
That's the part that cracked me up. He's just,
yeah, he's got a hunch.
They say, brakes, the road leads to a dead end. And he's like, no, just punch it.
Yeah.
It's like playing chicken with a mountain.
Yeah.
But he could have caught them all killed. What if it wasn't?
I know. He'd smash right into it.
It's like, it was camouflage. What a payoff. Well, what if it wasn't camouflage?
Yeah, he's pretty reckless throughout this whole thing. I mean, he's just crazy.
Some casualties, too, doesn't it? As far as, like, some of the members not making it through some of the...
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, as they go through, you definitely... There are definitely signs that of the people that have tried to make it before. Like, for example, there's a huge chasm that they have to jump over, and you get a panel showing down below where there's a bunch of different, you know, people on motorcycles and stuff like that that have crashed. There's a sequence of loose rock laying all over the road that they have to avoid so they don't wipe out. And then... So that Flipper Dipper has something to do. They go underwater, and there's like a water course to navigate, and Flipper Dipper has to swim out and blow up some blockage, some stone that's fallen and blocked the way.
Yeah, so he gets to be the hero there for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get the psychedelic kaleidoscope pictures.
Yeah, they're almost hard to describe. I mean, almost they remind me of, like, in 70s films when they want to show that somebody's really tripped out or having an acid trip or something like that. They'd have all these, you know, flashing images or, you know, actually what it reminds me of is in the original Charlie and the Chocolate Factory when they're going through that tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all these, like, strange images flashing and stuff. It kind of evokes that feel. You really kind of get the sense that, you know, they're going through this strange sequence that's, they have to, I think they say they have to use their radar to make sure they're still on the track, and otherwise they have no way of knowing where they're going.
Yeah, that image on the right, you know, as they're traveling through something, on to the right of the wagon, looks like it's a skull with a target and another skull in the eye, you know, in the other eye socket. And then the nose and then the bottom part of the jaw is missing. It just looks weird.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like it's almost in a collage effect or something, but yeah, it's really trippy.
Yeah, and if you look at the bottom one, the bottom panel underneath that, doesn't that look like the car's driving over, you know, through this thing, and at the bottom it looks like some guy's face screaming. Look at it, like laying in his back.
Oh yeah.
That's definitely crazy.
Like a huge face screaming up at them. Yeah, it's sort of creepy.
Yeah.
It's pretty awesome. I definitely wasn't expecting that when I turned the page. So that's pretty neat.
Yeah, so Superman's there back at the habitat pretending to be asleep.
Mm-hmm. Because there's some nurses taking care of, some hippie nurses taking care of him.
Right. So this is where he tries to catch up with them, and he says there have been casualties because he sees all the crashed motorcycles and stuff. You know, not all of them are making it through this mess.
Yeah.
And then he runs into the the Mountain of Judgment, which is a pretty freaking awesome vehicle. It's a whole mountain that moves, but it looks like a monster.
Yeah, it's a huge payoff. I thought it really, as you keep hearing about this Mountain of Judgment, you turn the page and it's this just awesome double page splash, and Superman's thought bubbles explain that it's a giant missile carrier that these people, the Harrys, have turned and decorated and kind of to make it fearsome looking and scare people away. And it looks like this kind of reminded me of those Chinese dragons that you see in Chinese parades and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's huge green dragon. It's just awesome.
Laying on top of a bunch of wheels.
Yeah.
With horns. It's pretty cool.
It's really cool.
And then you get cool scenes of Morgan Edge. He keeps worrying that Clark is going to bust some stuff up or mess things up, so he keeps calling his house. Are you okay, Clark? I know you got run over, just checking up on you. And Clark's got this really old contraption hooked up to his phone where it actually lifts up the receiver and puts it over the recorder. And I guess he's got like an infinite amount of messages, so he doesn't sound the same every time he calls.
Yeah, it's pretty, it looks old school because there's like a reel-to-reel on it, but considering what it accomplishes, it's pretty high tech. Because it basically has a conversation with him.
Yeah.
So it's pretty awesome. But I guess if you're Superman, you know, you got access to that kind of thing. So then we find out that the Harrys aren't bad guys after all. And because the Mountain of Judgment swallows up the Whiz Wagon, Superman goes in after it.
It's a tractor and, beam, like in Star Wars.
Yeah, yeah. And it turns out that the Harrys immediately start looking for something on the ship, and it turns out that there's a alpha bomb inside of the camera that Scrappy is using. So Superman grabs it and covers it so that he can absorb the blast. And we find out that the Harrys have enemies that they basically... This vehicle is basically... I think somebody calls it like a huge... mobile home, but it's basically that's where they live so they can stay on the move and avoid their enemies. And this whole assignment from Morgan Edge was basically a way of getting Olsen and the Newsboy Legion to deliver this bomb to the Harrys unknowingly and destroy them. Yeah, did you want to talk about the last couple panels that we've kind of mentioned already?
Yeah, it's just the first time you see Morgan Edge talking to Darkseid, and Darkseid just appears in one panel, and you just see his head.
Yeah.
And he's like, Morgan Edge is like, I await your orders, sire. And he says, do nothing, your plan has failed. I shall contact you soon.
Yeah. Yeah, we get... that's our first indication that he's... this person, Darkseid, is behind this. And that'll really come to greater fruition, and we'll find out more about him and where he comes from and stuff in the next batch of issues when we get into New Gods and stuff. But for now, we just know that this guy's behind Morgan Edge and what's going on here.
This 130, so, that leads us to 135, the final issue of this. And I'm really curious to see if I can find out who drew this cover, because it looks so different.
Yeah, actually, it's I was looking at the table of contents and it
mentioned. It's Neil Adams.
Yeah.
Yeah, so wow.
I thought
that face, you know, where Superman was, it's a bunch of Superman choking Superman. And yeah. I thought that face was Neil Adams. because I mostly know Neil Adams from Batman, but you know, you could mm-hmm. he has a distinctive art style.
Yeah, he did the cover of 134 also, whereas Jack Kirby did 133. And just looking at the table of contents here, it looks like he was basically, if Jack Kirby, he does a couple more, and there's a few that looks like he maybe inked Kirby's pencils for the cover.
Mm-hmm.
At least in his first volume, but yeah, so it's a Neil Adams cover.
So those that gripe about the cover artist not being inside the... that was happening way back then.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, at least they got another famous name to fill in.
Yeah.
So 135 is another issue that definitely gives us more information about what's going on. It starts off with these two masked figures who have created all these little miniature replicas of Superman and Jimmy Olsen, the Newsboy Legion. And we get a really cool splash page of Kirby Tech with all these floating containment chambers and whatnot. And once these guys take their helmets off, we find out that they are a guy named Makari, who has yellow skin and strange features, and then a guy that's kind of ape-like named Simeon. But they've recreated they also, in addition to these little tiny replicas, they've created a huge giant who has a mask on. We don't know who he's a replica of, but we know that they've created him to destroy Superman because Superman's, and they feel that he's their main opposition to mm-hmm. their plans.
And these two guys play a big part in DC's Final Crisis. So mm-hmm. it's kind of important from that perspective. And then you see more Makari in the New 52 OMAC. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah, I recognized him from that, and basically this, so from there we jump into Superman meeting with the Harrys, and this is kind of where, you know, you were saying that Superman knows a lot about what's going on, and we find out that he's spent some time talking to the Harrys, and he's also aware of a secret government project, which at first is called, he basically takes Jimmy Olsen and the Newsboys to the secret government installation called the Replica Station, and also called the DNA Project. And I think this is what later ends up being called Project Cadmus, right?
Yeah, that's what's badass about it. And plus, the thought that they're already talking about cloning, you know, back in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, we are cloning stuff now.
Yeah, and that's basically, you know, what Superman breaks it down for them, at least for Jimmy Olsen. He takes the Newsboy Legion, you know, they meet up with their fathers, the old Newsboy Legion, who are hanging out here and helping out. And, we got... you know, it's, if you read the first two issues and you're thinking this Flipper Dipper guy is, you know, thinking it's kind of silly that he's walking around constantly in scuba gear no matter where they're at, it cracked me up that his father tells him to take the stuff out.
Take it off. It's ridiculous. Yeah,
basically, what the heck are you doing, son?
He said, this room may spring a leak. What are you going to do?
So I thought that was pretty cool that he called him out on that.
And then I thought it was fascinating, you know, Superman's leading him down the hallway, he introduces Jimmy to one of the guards, and then the guards takes off his helmet, it says Olsen 43. So he's like the 43rd clone, and he's like, well, what number are you? And he's like, life number? What the hell's that? And Superman says, well, he's life number one. In other words, he's the original.
Yeah, so pay your respects, or he considers it an, like 43 considers it an honor to meet number one.
And then Jimmy is looking at a microscope and seeing a bunch of little Jimmies.
Yeah. Little tiny miniature Jimmy Olsen's in their underwear.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So crazy. So awesome. But yeah, so we flip back to the quote-unquote bad guys, Mokari and Simeon. They take their giant and they basically coat it in kryptonite spray. So they got this jolly green giant that they, and then they end up talking to, we get another appearance of Darkseid, but again, only on a monitor where he talks to these guys and you know, are at this point probably suspected as much, but it's confirmed that they're working for this Darkseid guy as well. And but they basically lose control of their giant, and they save themselves from being destroyed as the giant starts, you know, wrecking shop. They use this thing called the penetrator beam, which is apparently what they use to... So they actually stole tech from Project Cadmus, and that's where they got the duplicating technology, the cloning technology. And they fire this beam to send the giant over to Project Cadmus, where Superman and Jimmy Olsen are.
And they have a big fight scene where he pretty much knocks out Superman, but before Superman punches him in the face and his mask comes off and he sees, like, it's a Jimmy face.
Yeah. Yep, it's a giant green Jimmy Olsen.
And then you got a bunch of Jimmies in military outfits shooting at him.
Yep. Yeah. Jimmy, so all these Jimmy Olsen clones are fighting a giant green Jimmy Olsen clone. And then we finish up the issue with another cool reveal. As this battle's going on with Superman and, well, the giant pretty much takes out Superman because he's coated in kryptonite. And elsewhere in the labs, the four original Newsboy Legion, who are now men, they reveal to Jimmy, the original Jimmy Olsen, number one, that they have a cloning project of their own. And the last page is a splash that reveals that they have cloned the Golden Guardian, and they let him out to battle the giant.
They also make it a point to mention all of their occupations. I thought was interesting.
Yeah, like what they're
and doing. They like reference themselves in the first person, like Gabby as a teacher. I'm big words. I'm a geneticist, and one guy's a social worker, and then Tommy is a medical doctor.
Yeah, it's a little clumsy in terms of it's not really probably how people would talk, but it gives you a chance to catch up, you know. These characters were created in the 40s by Kirby with Joe Simon. And I actually, you know, in the research, a little bit of research I was doing, the Golden Guardian also is a Simon Kirby creation. His history is tied to the original Newsboy Legion. They actually both... their first appearance was in the same comic, which is Star Spangled Comics number 7 in 1942. So I thought that was cool, you know, the way that he's bringing in some of his old creations with Joe Simon.
Yeah, this was a good walk down memory lane, because I don't remember liking it that much when I read it. I mean, I remember liking the art a lot, but I don't remember the story all that well, and this was just refreshing. It's cool to see how many characters show up in this, and a lot freaking happens in 3 issues. You can't really say a lot about that in today's comics.
Yeah, it's definitely pretty packed with concepts and information, and you know, that I think I might have mentioned last time that before I really started getting into DC stuff and find out about DC comics as someone that grew up reading Marvel, you know, I mostly knew Kirby's 60s work, creating, you know, Fantastic Four and the other stuff that he worked on for Marvel in the 60s, and becoming familiar, you know, that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this, because I've found out about different things here and there that he's done and seen samples of his art, and I really like his art a lot. I just love and am fascinated by these concepts and wanting to
And you know what? I will honestly say he's a damn good writer too. if he's writing these stories, plotting them, and then putting the words on the page, I actually find this more enjoyable than reading a Stan Lee pen page. At least I didn't notice all the damn exclamation points that Stan puts in. But there's a lot of them.
Yeah, for only being, like I said, about 6 or 7 years after the early Marvel stuff that Stan Lee wrote, it's not, you know, of course it's from the early 70s, so there are some colloquialisms and some storytelling techniques that have gone out of fashion over the last, you know, 40 years, but for the most part, it definitely is a lot less dependent on captions to tell the story.
Right. It's all kind of like them talking. But there are a lot of exclamation points. Everybody's shouting all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that was just a thing of the time, though. That they either didn't want to put a period, or it either ends with a question mark, a dot, 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 or an exclamation point.
Yeah, they definitely, everything was very top, you know, very exciting. But yeah, I like the way that this kind of almost acts like a prologue to the whole Fourth World saga.
Yeah, very sci-fi. Sci-fi.
And Kirby, from what I've read, definitely was intending to do a huge, large-scale story. If anyone out there is wanting to read along, you know, if you have the Omnibus, it's pretty obvious which the next few issues are, but we, at this point, get the introduction of the original series that Kirby started. So we get the first issues of Forever People, New Gods, and Mr. Miracle coming up next before we get another issue of Jimmy Olsen. And I would say definitely we start to see some really huge signs of what Kirby's going after with this whole series in these next books.
Big scale.
So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, especially with the New Gods, you know, you have essentially what comes down to Kirby creating his own mythology, you know, his own cosmology in some ways. And I mean, we talk some more about it when we do cover New Gods number one, but I think part of the concept is, I've read, you know, it's not something I observe myself, but I've read people talk about the way that in covering Thor, in writing Thor with, in doing Thor with Stan Lee before he left for DC, this almost kind of continues, because in Thor, I think he dealt with the whole mythology of like the Norse myth of Ragnarok and the destruction of the gods.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like that mythology with Thor and all that were the old gods. And even though he can't explicitly state that because he's working for a new company now,
I wonder if they really gave him full reign. In other words, I wonder if an editor said, well, you can start your story, but you're going to have to do some couple issues of Jimmy Olsen. You know, I'm really curious to know what happened.
Yeah, like, me too.
Like, why Jimmy Olsen? Like, why start it there? It just seems like a, you know, knowing everything that's coming next, right? It just seems like an odd place to say you're going to start on Jimmy Olsen. You're one of the fathers of the Fantastic Four, the New Gods. And I'm sure that Jimmy Olsen sold really well at the time, like, because mm-hmm. it went so far. There's so many issues, like, you know, of Jimmy Olsen. But I'd die to know what the sales numbers of that were, as opposed to, like, why not put him on The Flash or, you know, Green Lantern or, you know what I mean? It's just weird. It's like, did he control his destiny? Or was there some editor there saying that we'd like to revive your characters again? Or if we said, we're giving you full reign, do what you want to do. And it almost looks like they gave him full reign. I mean, just because I've read so much of what's coming, and just say, do what you want to do. And unfortunately, a lot of the books didn't succeed, like go 100 issues or, you know, they didn't go that far.
Yeah,
I think Commandy was the longest running one, and it wasn't all Kirby either.
Right. Yeah, and I think the three titles I just mentioned, I think all of them go to maybe 11 issues, I want to say.
Yeah.
Between, you know, so each one of them, so I mean, you do have 33 issues there of Fourth World Story, but yeah, my inclination is to think that they, and I think that was one of the reasons that they were able to attract him over, because he was getting frustrated at Marvel, you know, for not getting the credit he felt he deserved. So I think they tantalized him by allowing him to have control over what he wanted to do. And it certainly seems that way. I mean, the ideas are very, you know, Kirby-esque and very... they have that sort of strange creativity about them that suggests that he's kind of doing what he wants to.
And I even think he did a lot of it in Marvel, because the Marvel way was just weird to me. It was really, mm-hmm. really weird. It's like somebody writes on a sketch pad a concept and, you know, what the characters are and stuff like that. And then the other guy's writing, he's actually making the story. So even though he's the artist, back in the Marvel way, the artist was the, you know, the plotter and the storyteller.
Yeah.
They were given such a loose plot that they had to come up with the story. They had to come out with the flow. Mm-hmm. Yes, you had an editor there saying, well, maybe make this longer and stuff like that, because I think editors were bigger back then than they are now. But
yeah, my suspicion is on a lot of the concepts. You know, it's clear at this point Kirby had been working in comics for several decades, and his storytelling abilities are obviously really refined. I mean, and I think this could have been a huge flop, a huge failure in terms of its staying power and longevity, because these concepts are so bizarre and out there that number one, I love it because it's something that probably could only be done in comics. But I think the other thing is that if he wasn't such a good storyteller with his art, if you had an amateur artist or a less experienced storyteller trying to convey these concepts, I think it'd be really easy to lose the thread of what's going on.
Yeah.
You know.
It was really good. I'm looking forward to jumping into the next series of stories.
Yeah, definitely.
So what else do you got? Well, I actually thought we'd do some questions just to get a break from the comic talk, just for a little flow change.
Yeah.
But sure, I was thinking good. If we could both name a hobby or activity that we liked as a kid other than comics.
Oh yeah, okay. That's a good one.
Well, for me, I've always liked collecting, so I collected a lot of sports cards.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing really early on I was big into was marbles. because during recess, marbles back in the day was a big thing. In other words, you'd go to like these dirt areas of, and you'd make these like you'd make a line, and basically you'd make a pyramid of marbles, and you'd roll a marble and try to knock down the pyramid, and if you knocked down the pyramid of marbles, you'd get all those marbles. But if you missed, you'd take the marbles. So the idea was, if you couldn't knock down that period, even if you hit it and it didn't fall down, you'd get to keep the marble. So as you know, as a pyramid builder, you'd get to keep all the marbles that were rolling by.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I never really played marbles as a kid. I mean, I've heard of other people talking about them and stuff. You know, I know early on action figures. I also did do the baseball card thing, but action figures were definitely a big thing. And then, you know, I definitely got into Nintendo early on. I can remember playing Atari at friends' houses, but the first video game system we ever had in the house was the Nintendo with Super Mario Brothers.
You know what my first video game system was?
Coleco?
No. I don't think you'll ever get it. It's the like thing called a Fairchild.
I'd never even heard of that, so no, yeah. I wouldn't have.
I'll have to put a picture of that sucker. But it was a very this gaming system had like Pong. It had some like really weird games that are very straightforward. But at the time when you're playing this as a kid, it was just like amazing. We'd play the Fairchild for hours. And it led us into saving up, me and my brother, you know, saving our money for mowing lawns and allowance and all that stuff for our first Atari.
Oh, cool. Was it similar to an Atari, the Fairchild, or not really?
No, it didn't even have like a joystick. It had like this weird stick, and it had this little knob on the top, and the knob was the way you'd move around. You know, you'd move the knob around, and if you pushed down, that was kind of your fire or your release. Do you know what I mean? So you could push down on the knob, and that was your release. It was a very odd system, but it was a lot of fun. And then Atari 2600 came out, and me and my brother play that for hours. And like we still have it's at my brother's house. We still have a ColecoVision with an Atari 2600 adapter, which you can plug into the ColecoVision and, you know, play these Atari 2600 games. And we still have like a lot of the originals. You know, sometimes when I go to his house, or we'd still play like Combat and I forget the other one was the Air Combat one, and all the goofy games like Laser Blast, and they're not a hell of a lot of fun now, but back in the day, they were they'd last us hours. And me and my brother were fortunate enough to never have like, I don't know, we didn't have like strict guidance, like you have to go to bed at 8, or you know what I mean. So me and my brother would stay up till like midnight or 2 a.m. playing that, and then we'd get up again at 4 a.m. and start playing again. So it's like our eyes and stuff were probably destroyed from all that.
Yeah, I mean, I know I had some rules in terms of how long I was allowed to play the Nintendo and stuff, but my parents were pretty liberal with allowing me to do it, though. I know I definitely spent a lot of time. One of my favorite memories as a kid was when Super Mario 3 came out, and at the time, you know, GameStop, that kind of thing didn't exist, and there was a video game, it wasn't even really a store at the mall, it was a kiosk in the center of one of the hallways, and Super Mario 3 coming out was such a big deal. My mom, who wasn't working at the time, went while I was in school and stood in line most of the day to buy it for me. And
the sacrifices our parents made to keep us happy, right?
I know. It was just, and it worked, because I mean, you know, this many years later, I still think about how awesome that was, getting home and having the game there ready for me. And she, besides stopping to eat dinner, she, you know, I normally wouldn't be able to play all night, but she basically let me play until I went to bed that night, you know.
Yeah, times have definitely changed. I mean, my parents used to just let us go do our thing. Like, we go to Kmart you know, where they'd go do the blue light special or whatever, and they would just let us go wherever. And now it's like you have to watch your kids because it just seems a much dangerous world, or more. Maybe it was dangerous back then, but you just didn't hear about it as much. You know what I mean? So we had freedom, and the one freedom that you don't really see is, I used to go to my buddy's house, and my buddy was you know, 5 or 6 houses down the block. So, mm-hmm. And I used to go to his house, and we used to play till like 10 or 11 at night. And never once did we ever think about, well, is it going to be dangerous walking home at 11 o'clock at night?
Yeah, just the amount of time that I would be gone from the house without checking in, you know, and
everybody knew everybody back then. Do you know what I mean? It's like you knew every single neighbor by name, and you knew who lived in every single house, and you talked to them almost daily. Whereas now, I think you drive into your garage and maybe close your garage.
Yeah, that's kind of how, especially, I think, you know, because of, I think my parents pretty much knew everybody on the street, partially because at the time there were a lot of other families who had kids either same age or a little older or a little younger. You know, we were always over at either side of, you know, the neighbors on either side of the house, always playing with their kids and stuff. And partially it's because a lot of the same families still live there, but the kids are grown, you know, but the neighborhood's much quieter. You know, you don't see the kids running around. I mean, because most of them live in developments and streets nearby that didn't exist, that were just fields when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's one thing that's changed about my parents' neighborhood, is just how much has been developed that used to be fields that, you know, that we would run around in and build forts in and, you know, run away from four-wheelers in.
Yeah.
You know, we constantly rode our bikes up to, you know, the corner store. That was our big thing, too, was just riding bikes up to the corner store.
Yeah, bike riding was a real big thing back then. That's how you got around, at least farther than walking. You'd ride your bike.
Yep, and spend all my money on like hot dogs and huge sodas and baseball cards and all that stuff.
And basketball was a huge part of my life, because in our neighborhood, every house had a basketball court. And we would play till all hours of the night. Matter of fact, our parents would build lights so we could keep playing. And I was it's weird because where I grew up, nobody was really tall. So it was very strange, but yet we all made the high school basketball teams and stuff because we just played so much. I mean, it was like a lifestyle. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You'd come home, you'd maybe do some homework, and then you'd play basketball.
Yeah, I wasn't into sports later on, but when I was a kid, like in elementary school and stuff, the main thing that we played was pickup football. And we definitely played tackle.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, like, it eventually turned into, like, we got rid of a lot of the rules and it turned into a game called Crazy Tackle where we would just like all group up together and then someone would throw the ball in the air and you just tried to scramble for the ball, and you know, basically everyone had their own points and you scored points by getting to the touchdown, and whoever had the ball, everyone else tried to tackle that person. So it was pretty insane, and we played in like this kid's front yard that had a big tree in the middle of it, so people were always running into the tree accidentally. And I come home like torn clothes and like bloody knees and just ridiculous. Now it'd be like put some helmets on.
Yeah.
That, I don't know.
And when I first started basketball, I didn't even know how to do a regular shot. I would do a granny shot or throw it over my head backwards.
Nice.
That's how I first started to learn to shoot. But, yeah, that was a lot of fun. So the other question that came up is, what was one of your favorite foods growing up as a kid?
Oh. I have to think about it for a minute.
While you're thinking about it, I'll let you know what mine is, because I lived off of it for such a long time, and I was very, I guess, picky. I was a very picky eater. I don't know how my parents put up with me, because I think for like a good 2 years, maybe a year of my life, all I wanted was mashed potatoes. I mean, that was like all I'd ever eat. So my mom had to like keep like, she'd make homemade mashed potatoes, but if she didn't have those, she'd make that, you know, the dehydrated kind or whatever, the potatoes in a box.
Yep.
But that's,
I know them well.
That's kind of how, that's all I would eat for like 2 years before I started to even try anything. So
yeah,
that was one of my favorite foods.
That's funny that you said that, because that was actually the first thing that came to my mind was mashed potatoes. The reason I said I'd think about it was because I was trying to remember, like, I still love mashed potatoes, and I can't remember when I started loving mashed potatoes. Like, it seems like I always have, so I don't really know if I did when I was a kid, because I still, you know, when I lived alone, I used to, when I lived by myself, I would get those box mashed potatoes like you were talking about all the time. You know, I always made sure I had a supply. You know, it's like usually like...
Just to add water.
Yeah. What am I going to have with mashed potatoes tonight? And I don't know, they seem gross to me now, but I know I was definitely big for a while on those hot dogs that have the cheese in the center.
Oh, yeah. I didn't have this when I was a kid.
They
didn't get that sophisticated.
I'm trying to remember if I know later on, like maybe, you know, middle school and stuff like that, that they had. I don't know if I had them when I was real little.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, especially in elementary school, I have some memories, but it's definitely spotty how much I remember. You know, there's specific things that really made an impression on me. Like one other thing I remember you were mentioning when you mentioned collecting baseball cards was another thing that I thought was really cool that my mom came up with was for one of my birthday parties in elementary school. She bought all these packs of baseball cards, and she opened them all up and spread them out on the living room floor. And then me and all the other boys that I had over for the party put on blindfolds, and we basically... I don't know where she came up with this, but we crawled around on the floor basically like picking up baseball cards, knocking each other over to try to get them. So they basically keep as many as you could grab. You couldn't see if they were good or not, you know?
Yeah.
But I still...
Damn, I got a Happy Days card. Damn it.
Yeah. So that was pretty awesome. It was like a free-for-all.
Yeah, that sounds like a cool game.
I'm surprised I didn't... I still have not broken any major bones.
Yeah.
Talking about things that I did when I was a kid, I'm kind of amazed. The only thing I broke when I was a kid was my pinky toe.
I broke my arm. I was on the wall playing Spider-Man. We had brick walls that were about, I guess they were about 5.5 feet tall. Uh-huh. And I was just walking on one and fell off. And at the time... that TV show was on, like the 1970s Amazing Spider-Man show. And I was, the music used to go doot 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 doot, and I used to walk on the wall humming the song, and I fell over and broke my arm.
Ouch. The early dedication of a lifelong comic book fan.
So the next question I had is, like, what was your first sitcom that you ended up watching?
Well, I don't know if this is the first one. It probably was, but definitely by far was my favorite was The Cosby Show.
That was a good show. I caught
that. That was definitely a family event. Yeah. We all sat down as a family and watched that. And basically, you know, a lot of the other shows I saw were because they stuck them on after the Cosby Show, like different spinoffs and stuff. But that era, I think, was it NBC?
Yeah, it was a Thursday night NBC.
I mean, I usually had to go to bed before Night Court came on, but you had like Cheers before that, and
yeah, those were great shows. Night Court, yeah. Cheers.
Yeah, they, and you know, they, I think they tried a lot of different shows after Cosby Show because Cosby Show was so successful. But I mean, I still do love. I'm actually looking right above my computer here. Maybe like 13 years ago, 14 years ago, my sister sent away I have an 8x10 black and white picture of Bill Cosby that he signed in a frame right here, because that she sent away and asked for. But yeah, I've always been a fan of him because of that show. And also his
stand-up.
Stand-up at himself video. My sister and I used to watch that, and we'd just roll around on the floor laughing.
It's still funny.
Yeah.
It still holds up.
His style.
And it was clean. Flat. It was weird. Because it was, you know, I'd listen to that and then like Richard Pryor and stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, they're both geniuses, but definitely different styles.
Yeah, for me, I kind of grew up with All in the Family and the Jeffersons. Mm-hmm. And All in the Family was kind of racist. I mean, it was a really racist show because Archie was a real asshole.
Yeah.
And then Harley's screaming because Barb just left. She's like, where are you going? I think she's got like a separation anxiety thing.
Yeah.
She doesn't like when we're separated or when somebody leaves without her. But one of the ones that I really, really, really enjoyed is, I guess this was later, was Three's Company. I still think that's funny. And it really was the same shit every episode. It was the same show every episode. But I loved it. It was good.
Yeah, all the stuff you're talking about, I saw, you know, in reruns on
TV Land.
Nick at Night or TV Land, yeah. Yeah, actually, another one that I was huge on as a kid was Dukes of Hazzard.
Oh yeah,
I think
that's a Chuck Star Joe's.
Yeah, I think Daisy Duke rather. Freudian slip, making that plural. she was. I think as a young kid, I think was one of the first women I really thought was pretty. You know, I remember my mom teasing me about it, you know.
Oh yeah, for me it was Farrah Fawcett from Charlie's Angels.
Oh yeah, I could see that if if I was watching that at the time.
Yeah, having three beautiful women on the TV at one time was pretty awesome.
Yeah. That's cool.
So what else did I write? What is one toy that you no longer have that was part of your collection that you wish you did have?
Oh, man. You can go ahead. I'm going to look up the name of it because I just forgot the name of it, but I know I can picture it in my mind. But I'm going to see if I can find the actual name of it.
Well, for me, I own most of what I had as a kid because I was real anal about keeping my toys and stuff in good shape, and I never got rid of anything. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of my old, like Big Jim's pack, my Mego dolls, my Star Wars first generation, and all my action figures from like Superpowers and all that stuff. Mm. But the one thing that I was never able to find, and this, I think it happened when I decided to move to Colorado from New Mexico, was my Millennium Falcon, the very first one. I had it, and now I don't. I have replaced it with the newer version, which looks a lot better, but that original version I sure wish I had.
Yeah, I think that's a holy grail for a lot of Star Wars collectors if they don't have it.
Yeah.
Or just to even have a version of it.
But I like maintained everything else. Like I have my Death Star, which back in the day it was, I don't know, it was about 2 feet tall. And it had mm-hmm. the trash compactor at the bottom and the big gun at the top. the one that would blow stars up and everything.
Yeah.
It had different levels in the Death Star. And I still have that intact. And interesting enough, we were watching Toy Hunter the other day. I watched that as like a show me and Barb watch when we don't have anything else to watch. But we were watching it, and they had the Guns of Navarone playset. And Barb was like, oh, wow, that's worth $100? And I was like, and that was outside of the box. And I said, Barb, go down to the basement. As you're coming down the stairs, look towards the window. Well, and you'll see that Guns of Navarone in its original box.
Oh my gosh!
She never knew it. She'd never seen it before.
Yeah, your basement is like her life insurance policy. That's awesome. Yeah, I know that you've mentioned on other shows that you have a lot of your old stuff, and I'm pretty jealous whenever someone says that, because I mean, I was into a lot of the 80s properties. Star Wars was the first big one for me, and I had a lot of Star Wars figures. And I had the Darth Vader collector case, which basically the Darth Vader head. There was one of C-3PO, too, but it had slots for all the figures. Mm-hmm. And I also was pretty big into G.I. Joe and, to a lesser degree, Masters of the Universe. I think the biggest one definitely were Star Wars and G.I. Joe, maybe G.I. Joe a little bit more so than Star Wars. I had a lot of the vehicles and stuff, and the one I was trying to think of, the official name of it, that if I had to pick one thing that I wish I still had, because I basically, if it's not already implied, I basically don't have anything. I think a lot of it got sold at garage sales and stuff when I was in high school, and I thought, you know, I'm never going to want this stuff. But I had the Mobile Command Center, which came out in the mid 80s, and is this huge vehicle for the Joes. And I'm trying to see if this has any information on its dimensions or anything. I'm looking on yojo.com. Has millions of pictures, but it was basically, as it sounds, this huge vehicle that opened up, and it has missile bay and a service bay, and it's probably the biggest toy I had, and it was basically, once I had it, it became the center of my anytime I was playing Joe's. Here we go. It retailed for $34.99 in 1987. So
it seems like when I'm watching that show, there's a lot of like cool G.I. Joe stuff, but that was one property. When G.I. Joe and Transformers came out, which is a lot of what kids, you know, remember, that are probably a generation or, you know, a decade younger than me.
Right.
Hold fond, you know, memories of, but I never, ever got into those properties because at that time I was coming out of toys.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I think the last one I really got into was Ninja Turtles, but that was right on the cusp of me losing interest. So basically the first wave or so of Turtle stuff that came out, I had a lot of that. And then anything after that was after I lost interest. But
what was the first generation Turtles? Were they Playmates?
Yeah, they pretty much always been Playmates, except for when more recent years, when a different company has gotten a limited license to do maybe more specialized figures. But, you know, Playmates basically still exists because of the Turtles. That's been their big moneymaker.
See, I think I have the original Turtles, the original four, in my basement. Mm. But I don't know if they were like first generation or second generation. Because I also have when Playmates was doing the Dick Tracy characters. I have the full run of the Dick Tracy characters as well. And that's kind of odd because that was kind of when I wasn't really into a lot of the toys. I've always been into the superhero toys, but that, you know, that was a given. Yeah. But the other properties, I kind of never, I never had a He-Man. So, and G.I. Joe's like brand spanking new to me. I've only been reading since the IDW stuff. So,
yeah.
And I'm reading some of the old Image stuff now, but that was a new title that I like. I wish I would have gotten to Transformers. I'm kind of glad I missed because I don't. Every time I dip my toe in that, I don't enjoy it, and I keep poking around every now and then and trying it, and I never can get into it. Whereas the Ninja Turtles, I've always enjoyed. I enjoyed their movies. I enjoyed the comics.
Yeah, that's kind of the same ones that I've, as far as picking up 80s properties and revisiting them, the main ones that I'm following in their newer incarnations is G.I. Joe and Ninja Turtles. I didn't, you know, despite the fact that I was into comics as a kid, I pretty much did stick to superhero stuff. I didn't really, and I don't know that it overlapped. I mean, I think I played with toys and collected toys a lot more before I got into comics. I mean, I believe that there was some overlap there, but once I got into comics, I was pretty focused on them and just reading in general. So I think I did read some of the Turtles comic that was based off of the TV show, but I've only recently been going back and checking out. I've been getting the collection, the hardcover collections of the original Turtle stuff that IDW has been putting out, and reading those now. You know,
is it the color reprints or is it the original?
No, the
black and white.
Yeah, the hardcovers are the original black and white. They're oversized. I grabbed the first issue of. They've been putting them out in single issues. The color reprints. I grabbed an issue of it just to check it out, but it's not. There's not enough to spend the money on those as well. It's not enough of a difference. It's not enough of an appeal to me.
Yeah,
I'm fine with just reading the black and white hardcovers. But yeah, I think with the Turtles, I like the family aspect of it because anytime, whether it's with the old ones or the new ones, anytime like there's something that happens between the Turtles and, you know, they're and Splinter as their father, and you know they have that family unity for some reasons. Sometimes I even get like choked up.
Yeah.
Or this oversized rat and is for turtle children.
Yeah.
But the family aspect of it really comes through for me, and I'm like, oh. So.
Well, that was the last question I came up with, and I was hoping that, you know, listeners in the future will supply more questions for us. But I thought it was a good introduction to, you know, talk about some other things outside of comics.
Yeah, I like that too. I think that's part of the appeal of the concept. That was one thing that kind of just happened last time that I like talking, you know, because it's all, a lot of this stuff is tied into memories, you know?
Right.
Yeah, and that also makes me think to mention that, you know, if people do, whether you already belong to the Forum for Geeks or you want to check it out within the Geek Brunch forum there. It's forumsforgeeks.com. And, you know, we have a thread already for the first episode. I'd love for people to come there and just talk about, whether you want to talk about the stuff we talked about in the episode or just if you want to bring up, you know, stuff that you remember from, you want to answer some of these questions that we were just talking about, or you want to talk about, you know, back issues that you remember, stuff that you're collecting now, working on. I'm pretty active in the forums for geeks over like on the Star Joes on their forum and stuff like that, just because I have an app on my phone called Tapatalk that I can access the forums from my phone. So I check it pretty often if anyone is in the mood to go there and chat some old stuff as well.
Sure. Could also go to Facebook too and Geek Brunch and find that and post stuff there as well.
Yep. There's a Geek Brunch page on Facebook. It's definitely another place to do that. So that'd be cool. But yeah, did you want to jump back into comics?
Sure.
I know you've been reading some stuff.
Yeah. I'll let you talk one. Have you read anything else outside of this fourth world?
Yeah, I got a few things. A couple of things that actually kind of carry over in theme from the last episode, some of the things that I talked about. I ended up filling in some more of the Legion, because I'm working on getting a run of the Legion of Superheroes starting around 1980. For now, just kind of getting the issues that from when 259, when Superboy left the title, to when they, in the mid-80s, when they started the Baxter direct sales title. And getting some more issues in that that run there, I ended up with another one of the 16-page previews that I was talking about last time.
Right.
And this is another one that ties into something currently going on in the New 52. This was in Legion of Superheroes number 272, and it's Dial H for Hero, 16-page preview. And, of course, they have recently brought that back in a series called just Dial H. It's actually a concept that's popped up a number of times. But yeah, this is another 16-page preview. It is written by Marv Wolfman, and they're not broken down by responsibility. It just has credited on the art. I'm assuming this goes pencils, inks, colors, but it's Carmine Infantino, Frank Giaramonte, and Dennis Jensen. So this is actually the second time that the Dial H concept was used, apparently. There was a series that ran for a couple years in House of Mystery using the Dial H concept. And basically, there are these dials that you dial the word hero on, and it gives you a random superpower. So what we have in this installment is there's a kid named Chris King whose family moves into this house that has been abandoned for a while because people think it was haunted. And he goes to school, and he ends up becoming friends with this cheerleader named Vicky Grant. And they go back to the new house of Chris's family, and they find they go up in the attic and they find a box with a message on it that has a watch and this kind of necklace pendant type deal. And those turn out to both be hero dials. And they, Chris and Vicky use them, and gain superpowers. And one of the concepts about this series, or one of the gimmicks, was that you could write in with your superhero ideas, and they would use them in the comic. And they must have done this in advance of this preview, because throughout this book, or throughout this preview, they have whenever... So Vicky and Chris both turn into two superheroes each. And each time they turn, there's a little box that says who, the name of the person that created the character, and sometimes their age and where they're from. So, for example, the first hero that Vicky turns into is a woman named Futura, and it's credited to Jim Simpers, age 15, in Newark, Delaware. So the last page of the 16 is a form that you can fill out. It's got a bunch of different questions like, what's your name and how old are you and what are your favorite sports? And it's basically, there's a bunch of legal information.
So you're not stealing somebody's character.
Yeah, well, it says basically what it comes down to is if you submit this and we use it, your character is owned by DC.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so basically you sign over rights to DC.
Imagine if you created somebody that was big, making millions of dollars.
I know. And basically what you get for it is you get credited and you get a free t-shirt.
And they make a million-dollar motion picture.
Right, yeah. So what's funny about that is, so I'm reading the first couple of pages of this, and before we get to actually the them using the dial to turn into heroes, both apparently both Chris and Vicky, the outfits that they're wearing in the beginning, their clothes, were created or designed by reader contributors. So I'm looking, it says Chris's clothes were designed by Eric Daniel, age 14, Chucktawaga, New York. So I'm thinking, okay, I know nearby in one of the suburbs of Buffalo is Cheektawaga, and I've never heard of Chucktawaga.
They spelled it wrong.
So I'm assuming that's the case. I Googled Chucktawaga real quick, and of course nothing came up, and Google's like, do you mean Cheektawaga? So just out of curiosity, I showed it to Karen. I was, that'd be funny if he still lives here. You know, he'd be, in his 40s. So just on a whim, not expecting to find anything, I Googled Eric Daniel Cheektawaga.
Yeah.
And one of the first two search results was a Twitter account.
Uh-huh.
So I looked at the Twitter account, and I just looked to see who, because they didn't have a picture or anything. I was looking to see who they followed, and I saw that they followed DC Comics. So I was like, this might be the dude. So I sent him a message. I said, hey, by any chance, are you the Eric Daniel that was, that was credited in the Dial H for Hero preview? And about a half hour later, I got an answer, and it was him. So he said, yeah, they spelled the name of my town wrong. I was like, I know, I live in the area. I was just, on a whim. And so I talked to him a little bit on Twitter, and he said he never even got the t-shirt.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah. And but then he pointed me. So apparently, so this was issue 272 of Legion that this appeared in. And he said, yeah, actually, my name is mentioned in a issue of Legion of Superheroes, too, because and for issue 300, they had a contest. Like, the cover of Legion of Superheroes 300 is a group shot of the whole, basically anybody that had been a Legion member up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a composite image of a whole bunch of different artists drawing the different characters. And in the back, they lay out the rules of this contest. They give you the names of all the characters. They give you a list of artists. And you basically, the contest was to list, what character was, to basically match the character to the artist. And whoever, the winner would get a original page of Keith Giffen, Larry Malstedt art.
Wow.
From the issue. Yeah. So he pointed out, he said, I'm pretty sure that the winners were announced in an issue that focused on Starboy. He said, maybe it was issue 306. And I knew I had that. So I went and looked, and sure enough, he was right. He wasn't the winner. But he was one of the runner-ups who got a Legion poster, and he's listed there, Eric Daniel, and this time they did get it right, Cheektawaga, New York. So,
that's pretty awesome. That's a cool story.
Yeah. So I asked him if, has he kept up with comics over the years, and he said that he stopped for a while, but he started reading, even though he kind of misses the old DC universe, he has been reading I don't know which ones, but he said he's been reading like 10 different New 52 titles this past year. So
that's real cool.
Yeah, I thought that was funny.
You tracked him down on Twitter.
Yeah, yeah, I couldn't. I mean, I wasn't going to spend a long time on it, but yeah, that quick Google search ended up turning him up. So last night I was talking to him a little bit.
Are you the famous creator of this character?
Yeah, he designed Chris King's outfit. So I thought that was pretty neat to connect with a local Western New Yorker that was interacting with DC Comics. Oh, and the other thing I thought that was funny when I was looking at issue 300 was when I was looking for the rules of the contest. Or no, sorry, when I was looking at... It refers back to issue 300, but I was looking at the contest results in the back of 306. We were talking earlier about, you know, people writing in letters to complain stuff.
Right.
There's a letter directed to Paul Levitz that says, "The cover of 300 was terrible, terrible, terrible. Let me make this clear to you and anybody else who reads this letter. I... and many other fans, I'm sure, don't like group photo covers." So Paul's response is, "Yeah? Then explain the over 250 entries that have come into our offices already in the cover contest." And then it segues into, Karen Berger announcing the...
winner.
The winner, and, you know, it breaks down, you know, who all the characters were by, basically the answers. So I thought, I always, whenever I read these old comics, I always read the letter pages, because not only sometimes are they funny, but sometimes you also, in the responses, find some information that, you know, really hasn't been printed anywhere else.
So, right.
A research spot.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. It's history right there.
Yeah, so I mean, that was kind of all I had to say about that. Actually, I like the preview. I like the whole concept. It's fun. I was just going to mention that there was no Dial H for Hero book. They basically took over Adventure Comics from issues 479 to 490. They also appeared in New Adventures of Superboy 28 through 49, and that was the new title that was created at the same time as Superboy leaving Legion of Superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
There was a new number one. They teamed up with Superman and DC Comics Presents 44. And then, since Marv Wolfman was involved in a lot of these stories, there'd be more Dial H concepts over the years as it's been revived, as like in the New 52, as they've done. But the story of these two kids, Chris and Vicky, were resolved in New Teen Titans in the late 80s. There was a couple issues of New Teen Titans that they appeared in, and I think I read that Vicky goes crazy from using the dial so much or something like that.
Yeah. But, and in the 90s, they have that Will Pfeiffer Hero series, which is outstanding.
Yeah, I want to go back. I read an issue or two of that at the time. I had no familiarity with the concepts it was, but that was right around the time I was starting to try DC stuff. And
yeah.
Sounded cool. I didn't read a lot of it, but like to check it out again sometime.
Yeah, I'm real fond of that series. And I have a lot of the originals in the, what was it, House of Secrets or House of Mystery?
In the 60s, yeah.
Yeah, first. I have a lot of those.
Yeah.
I have a mishmash of the Adventure Comics that they appeared in, and I have no Superboy where they appeared.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always been fascinated with that concept. I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, me too. Because I think we both like obscure, strange superheroes and superpowers. And every time they use the dial, it's just another like wacky concept.
And sometimes you get the shit handed to you. Like you get some stupid ass power. You're like, what am I going to do with this?
Yeah, that's a good way to create like a dramatic situation. For sure.
Yeah, it's a good concept. I think never really took off, but it really should have, because I think that was like on par with the new Teen Titans as far as quality or concept, you know.
Yeah.
It could have relaunched it with New Teen Titans and maybe it would have seen more success or something.
Yeah, they keep coming back to the idea, so hopefully, I guess the sales on the current Dial H have been pretty, they've been decent, I think. Which surprises me a little bit, but the China Meville, I think he's got some crossover fans from people that are fans of his novels and stuff, so maybe that'll help.
Yeah.
But
very cool. One of the ones I've read is I mentioned this on the other Geek Brunch, is I started reading Artemis Requiem, and I actually finished it. She is a character that actually had the Wonder Woman mantle for a while back in, I think it was the 90s. She died near Underworld Unleashed. So this was the series that brought her back, and it was a weird series that brought her back because Wonder Woman had to go to Hades, and they never really explain how she could like leave her body and go to Hades. And Artemis was in Hell, and she was kind of like the lead woman that was the demon's plaything, but the demon let her do what she wanted. So when Wonder Woman came there, he says, "Oh yeah, Wonder Woman can be your slave or whatever." And Artemis was reluctant to leave Hell. The demon's name was like Dark Ring Hath. It was a weird looking demon. But he plays a big part in this series from 1996, in that it all circles back to like when she escapes Hell with Wonder Woman. She meets up with a team led by this guy Nathaniel, and it's a team called the Hellenders, and their whole team is put together to investigate supernatural activities and destroy demons. And Artemis is a big part of that, along with a character that is called Hank Jessup. She's a female that used to be a security guard guarding Freon, and she gets caught up with neo-Nazis and then joins this group. But it's a weird series, man. It's like every issue is so different, but then it circles around and closes in on itself. And you have one like 6-page spread of her having a wet dream. It's the weirdest thing ever. It's like Artemis dreaming about Sure Shot, which is a guy on the team. And I'm like, why are you having like 6 pages of this telling us this, you know? And the other girl walks in on her, and she's like, was I saying anything? Was I doing? And then she like walks away. No, I don't want to eavesdrop. And then she says, oh, Sure Shot. And I'm like, what the hell is this? But it has a weird ending because that Nathaniel guy turns out to be, he thinks he's talking to God, but he's really talking to this demon, Dark Ring Hath, who wants his ex-wife back, which is Artemis. So he married Artemis in Hell, and now that she's escaped, he wants revenge on her. So he puts together this group called Hellenders. So even though they're called Hellenders, they're really working for this demon. And everybody ends up surviving, except for that Nathaniel and some of the other superheroes that are part of this team. But it was very interesting with Ed Bennis art. So it was, Ed Bennis is still working for DC, and it's a very similar style. And Messner Loebs is the artist, but I enjoyed it. It was goofy at times, but it was entertaining as hell. There's one whole issue that revolves around reality TV, which I found hysterical. But even though it was funny at times, it was a serious tone book, and it was good. I enjoyed it. Some of these things you can laugh at, but they're fun to read.
Was it meant to be an ongoing, or was it a...
No, it was just the 6-issue stories that spun Wonder Woman after she died. It brought her back to life and made her become part of the DCU again. She didn't stay dead very long. She's one of those characters that came back really, really quick.
Yeah.
And there's just some weird stuff in there. There's just some odd stuff. Like, there's one woman that writes a letter to her when she's a teenager, and I guess she has a baby at It must be like in junior high, which you have to be pretty damn young to have a baby in junior high. And she has a demon baby, so she's asking for her help. And it's just a bizarre letter, man.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, like read the letter to see. And it's written like in kid style, like she doesn't even know proper English. It's weird. There's some interesting things in there. So if you get a chance to pick those up in a quarter bin there, it's quite interesting.
Yeah, they sound pretty strange.
Yeah.
Definitely some concepts in there I wouldn't expect to find in a Wonder Woman spinoff.
Yeah. Wonder Woman only plays into issue 1 and 2, and then they kind of go their separate ways. In other words, she goes into hell, rescues her, gets knocked out at the gravesite with the neo-Nazis, and then recovers at the hospital, and then you never see her again.
I can do a one that's kind of a quick one, change things up to Marvel, because I was going to try to, last time I talked about going back and using Mike's comic world to figure out by looking at covers, issues, Marvel issues that I read when I was a kid. And I tried to do that again, and I struck out 3 times in a row. Basically, you know, I'm looking for stuff on Marvel's Digital Unlimited website, and they have a lot of old stuff. They have a lot of newer stuff that's maybe 6 months old, and there's spots. There's really a ton of stuff on there, but there are spots in different runs that, where stuff is missing or issues are missing that they haven't added yet. And the first three I tried, I was going to mention them real quick. I still think maybe I'll try to track them down in print then. Where Daredevil 237 is an issue by Steve Englehart and Lewis Williams. It has, that was kind of neat that it had the claw on the cover, because the claw is a part of the first storyline in Mark Waid's current Daredevil run. I also looked for Captain America 324, which, you know, I just find it fascinating, all these crazy villains. I think I'm discovering that's part of why I like B-list characters and stuff, because I read these books when I was a kid. This was Mark Gruenwald and Paul Neary, apparently, and it has Whirlwind and Trapster on the front. Trapster is a guy that dumps glue all over the ground. And then the last one I looked for that I didn't find was Amazing Spider-Man 283, which this actually ties into that Avengers storyline that I was talking about last time with the Masters of Evil, because it has Absorbing Man and Titania on the cover, and they are part of his the whole posse that took down Avengers Mansion.
Mm-hmm.
And Spider-Man's in his black costume. This is before he found out that it was an alien symbiote. But this is by Tom DeFalco and Ron Frenz. So the issue I did end up reading was Hulk 340. And I didn't have this issue, but my friend did. And it was one of the issues that he had that I was jealous of, because both of us were obsessed with Todd McFarlane back in the day. And it's funny, reading this today, I mean, my tastes have really changed since back then, and to me, the art doesn't age that well. You know, I'm just not, my tastes, like I said, have changed. I'm just not as much of a McFarlane fan as I was when I was a kid. I just thought we were obsessed with it, though. And this is basically, it's a Peter David written issue, though, so it was pretty good, but it was mostly, as you might expect, from the cover, which has Wolverine holding up his claws and the Hulk's face is reflected in the claws. It's a fight mostly between Wolverine and Hulk. This being the Gray Hulk, but the whole thing of it is that Wolverine is really trying to resist his bestial urges, and the Hulk is traveling with Clay Quartermain and Rick Jones, and the Hulk's getting bored and frustrated, and they basically either have to let him go or get beat up by him. And he runs into the X-Men, who at this time are looking for Storm and Forge, who have lost their powers. And it's basically Wolverine is flying the X-Wing, or not X-Wing. Yeah, it's a Star Wars crossover. It's pretty wild. What is there? The Quinjet?
Blackbird?
That's the Avengers. Yeah, the Blackbird.
Oh, no, that's the X-Men. The Quinjet, you got it. That's the Avengers.
Too many planes. Anyways, Wolverine. It's Wolverine, Rogue, Havoc, Dazzler, Longshot, and the British version of Psylocke.
Then that's probably the Blackbird.
Yeah. So basically, the Hulk eventually convinces Wolverine to fight. There's a little subplot indication featuring the leader in Half-Life. And we also get some pages of Betty Banner sort of crying over a picture of Bruce Banner. But basically they have a fight in Dallas near like the Fort Worth or near the Dallas Fort Worth airport, and Wolverine eventually gives in to the Hulk egging him on, and they fight for a while, and then Quartermain and Rick Jones catch up, and Quartermain yells at them, basically is kind of like the stern father, and tells Wolverine he probably has something better to do and he should know better, and that's kind of it. But mostly I was just curious to read it to see what my reaction to it nowadays would be, and it was okay, but it really wasn't my thing. And I felt like the art didn't really age that well.
I still enjoy McFarlane's art. I'm still a big fan. So I have a couple of quick ones. I read this unusual book from 2000 from DC Comics. I have a lot of DC because I'm still trying to acquire every DC comic from 1970. But
yeah,
this title is bizarre. It's called Lazarus 5. It's created by three people. I guess it's Dan Jolly, somebody Harris, and Snyder. It doesn't say which Snyder. But and the art is by this guy Abnall. It doesn't even give first names, but it is such a bizarre. His name is Dusty Hamill. So this is Tony Harris, believe it or not. So Tony Harris, writer Dan Jolly, and Ray Snyder. This Lazarus 5, I even had a hard time following it. Like, what is actually happening? But you get the gist of it. There's this guy. He's a weird looking dude. He lost his job from the Baltimore Medical Examiner, and his wife is leaving him with his daughter, and his daughter is chewing him out because he gets late from work. This is before he lost his job. He gets home really, really late from work, and his daughter's saying, "You can't even go to my karate matches, and you don't even pay attention to me." And this guy seems like an emotional asshole. Like, he doesn't seem to care that his daughter's screaming at him, or he just seems like he's not even there. It's such a bizarre scene. And then his daughter runs out the house, crying, and gets hit by a car. So his like daughter's killed, and then his wife leaves him, and then he loses his job, and then he's at a railroad crossing, and then some car bumps him, and he ends up in the rail in the tracks, and then the train hits him, and then he dies. And then he's brought back to he's brought into the morgue and recruited by this as a fifth horseman. So you got the four horsemen of apocalypse, and he's recruited as the fifth by this organization called the Inquisition, and they're a covert group of demon hunters to protect the sanity of Earth. And it's just a weird series, and it's just bizarre, and I'm very interested to finish it just to see if it clears up a little bit, because right now it's kind of clear as mud where they're going with this, but it's only 5 issues, and I think I own all 5, so, and I think I could find them relatively fast, so I'm very curious about that. And then I read a cool comic from what year was this? 1981. It was Action Comics. This was written by Jerry Conway, who I've always liked, and the artist Kurt Swan. And at this time, Kurt Swan didn't have that barrel chest thing going on. He had more like a more defined midsection. And it's about this geek dude who works for this company, and he creates a clockwork man. And he's really, like, turned on like a clock. And it's so weird because they want to fire him because he was, like, creating this clockwork man during company time, and they never authorized him to do it. But this clockwork man could kind of, like, control things, and he makes weird things happen to Superman. Like, at this time, Superman's working for the TV station we just talked about. And he's in a TV show called Good Morning Metropolis. He's like in the morning show host. And and there's an incident where they're going to close down a children's hospital because they can't get the funding. Well, Superman builds a children's hospital at super speed. He comes back, and then he's like, why did I slow down? Like, he almost got fired from his job because he almost showed up late. What's going on? So it's like, during this whole comic, weird things are happening to him, whereas he's, like, missing, his timing is off, everybody's moving faster than him, and he's slowing down, and it's this clockwork man that's speeding things up. Like, he even tries to save Lois falling from a building, and he misses her, but uses his super breath to catch her. Mm. But he ends up going to find that building and then turning off the clockwork man, and there's no mention of the scientist that made him, but it was a pretty weird story. And then the backup story was an Atom story that featured the Calculator. Well, the Calculator became a really big player in the DC universe when Brad Metzler got a hold of him, and he kind of became the evil Oracle, if you will.
Right.
And back in this day, he was just a dude that had a keyboard or a punch pad on his chest, and he was going to try to steal this machine. It was called a hurricane harness from this professor at Ivy Town. That this hurricane harness could actually prevent hurricanes from happening. And it was weird because the scientist was going to go back in time and prevent one of the biggest hurricanes from happening, but I guess not change time, and I don't know how you could do that, because if 600 people died in this hurricane and then all of a sudden nobody died, I don't know how that could not change history, but that's yeah. that's what he was going to go do. And the Calculator shows up and tries to steal the contraption. And at this time, the Atom, it's weird because the whole Calculator costume is immune to the Atom. Like, every time he tries to get near it, it's like it prevents him from even going into his ear or anything. Like, he can't even do anything. And he even mentions it's like Green Lantern trying to fight Yellow, you know? So it was interesting. And Calculator actually ends up taking the device and kicking him into that time stream. And then it's to be continued. But that was a fun story. I want to see where that goes, but I probably won't get to it for another couple of years. But the awesome thing about these comics is, at this time period, any of the comics, you could read a single issue and kind of get the gist of what happened before and where it's going to go after.
Yeah.
So it's, you can kind of jump in. It was nice at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I read a weird story, Man-Thing number 14, for my Marvel pick. And it was by Steve Gerber and Alfredo Alcala. I haven't read much Man-Thing, other than I'm a huge Steve Gerber fan from the Defenders, but the art is, like, amazing. And it opens up, it's obviously continued from a previous storyline where I don't know much about, but the Man-Thing's in space and then he crashes into the ocean, and I don't really know how he got into space. And there's a pirate ship, and it's basically about a cursed pirate story, and some female that is in the modern world who's that a pirate in the past who this demon wants her to fall in love with him. And it's such a weird story, but Gerber's stories are, like, so sophisticated. I mean, you could pick up a Gerber story now and read it, and you're like, man, this guy was just so ahead of his time that you'll enjoy Gerber stories because they're so epic. If you like Kirby, you'll like Gerber because he just thinks outside the box.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of, he's the one that created Howard the Duck, right?
Yeah, Howard the Duck, and he wrote a lot of Man-Thing, and he did a lot of Defenders, and he did that series for DC about the guy who went to prison. I forget what that line was called, the fraction line or the icon line. I can't remember what it was called. But they had a bunch of weird titles like Kinetic and Faction and...
More recently?
Yeah.
Yeah.
High Time or something like that. I can't remember what it's called.
Hard Time?
Hard Time. There you go. Yeah. He wrote that. But he's done a lot of stuff. I know Kirby liked him too a lot because when he was trying to sue... I think he was trying to sue George Lucas when the Howard the Duck movie came out because Gerber kind of had some writing in there, I guess, about, you know, his creation and his property, how he owned it. And he didn't obviously win, but at the time, Kirby launched a book called Destroyer Duck that he did in dedication to Steve Gerber. So there's a Kirby-Gerber connection.
Nice.
Yeah. And then the last thing I wanted to mention, and I don't know if you've ever read this, but I'd recommend... if you get a chance to jump on this bandwagon, because it's so much fun. But it's the Contest of Champions. It was a mini-series. Yeah. Have you read that?
No, wasn't that... That was kind of the predecessor of Secret Wars, kind of?
Yeah, and this one I kind of did what you did. In other words, you're kind of like going back to your childhood and reading some stuff that you remember, or at least were aware of at the time. And this one, I remember buying off the spinner rack, and it kind of blew me away because it had so many characters that I've never seen before. Like, I think one of the big things about this storyline was that it was the Grandmaster and Death, and they make a bet. And the bet is whoever captures these four pieces across the globe and puts the team together to capture those four pieces... If the Grandmaster wins, his brother could bring back his brother, the Collector, who was an old Avengers villain. And if the Grandmaster wins, if the Death wins, she gets to keep Grandmaster's soul and power. And so it opens up like they capture. This was the time when the Avengers were like Wonder Man, the Beast, Vision, you know, Iron Man, Wasp, and Scarlet Witch. And the Beast is visiting because at this time he was a defender with Iceman and some of the other people. And they vanish. And then you cut to a panel where you have the Soviet super soldiers, which you don't see too much. But they're trying to fight the Red Ghost and they vanish. And then the Fantastic Four vanish and Alpha Flight vanishes. The Canadian supergroup, and I think it's the first appearance of Shaman. So even though Alpha Flight's been around, it's Talisman. I don't think that character's ever been seen before. And then it cuts to the X-Men. They vanish, Power Man and Iron Fist, Spider-Man, Dazzler. And then they have all these weird characters, like they're trying... Well, they have Son of Satan, which I always... You know, he's in hell fighting a demon and he vanishes. But they have, like, Red Wolf. This is... If you like Obscure, you're going to get Obscure. You got Red Wolf, Sunfire, the Black Knight. You get Peregrine, who's from France, and the Talisman, and from Argentina, the Defensor. From you get Shamrock... from Ireland, Sabra from where is she from? Israel, the Collective Man from China, Arabian Knight from Saudi Arabia, and Blitzkrieg from Germany. So it's like they're putting together what they're trying to show is how big the Marvel Universe is across very diverse areas.
Yeah,
and they collect them and they all meet, and it's kind of funny how. Various characters, like all the water-related characters are discussing stuff, and I guess the black characters feel like they have to get together and because they're all together in one panel, and there's not a lot of black characters. There's like Talisman, Black Panther, Luke Cage, Falcon, and Brother Voodoo. So it just shows how small black character representation is in comics almost, at this time.
Almost
Harley. Oh. What'd you hear, Harley? But that's all it does is set it up. But it's a lot of fun, as it sets up the competition, and the teams are so bizarre because you think you'd get like big hitters, like if the Grandmaster's picking his team, and then Death is picking his team, and the Grandmaster's team consists of, why would you pick some of these characters when you have like other characters that are so much more powerful? But he picks Captain America, Talisman, Wolverine, Darkstar, Captain Britain, that Argentina hero, Defensor. Like, why would you pick Defensor, who has a shield, when you have Captain America? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, what's your strategy there? Sasquatch from Alpha Flight, She-Hulk, Thing, Daredevil, that Peregrine guy from France, and Blitzkrieg. Like, why would you pick Peregrine, Blitzkrieg, and Defensor? You know, I could see having the mystical guy, Talisman, but
yeah.
And then to be like Captain America's equivalent, the other Death picks Vanguard, that Soviet super soldier, Iron Man, Iron Fist, Shamrock, Storm, the Arabian Knight, Sabri, Collective Man, Sunfire, Sue Storm, Angel, and Black Panther. Those are odd teams.
Yeah.
I mean, because if you're picking teams, wouldn't you strategically pick like somebody strong, somebody strategic, somebody who's a leader? You know what I mean? That can put the team together.
Right.
Yeah, it was just
that's pretty haphazard.
It's bizarre. Yeah, but you can see what every character that they're trying to spotlight all the characters that are from different countries is what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have all 8 or 9 of them on each team. When you could have like the Hulk, and I mean, yeah. Why wouldn't you take them? And there's some weird rules, like you can't pick any Inhumans or aliens or Atlanteans, and I don't know, it's just bizarre.
Yeah, that's one of the criticisms I've heard over the years of the series, just that it's very, you know, kind of the gimmick is pretty obvious, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't realize that there were so many strange, obscure characters in it, so that kind of increases the appeal to me.
Oh yeah, you'll love it, because that's what increased the appeal to me at the day. I'm like, who are these characters? And sure yeah. enough, a lot of them are, you know, their first appearances of. So
yeah, that was kind of beginning of the Jim Shooter era, wasn't it, that came out?
Let me see who the editor-in-chief was. This was written by like 3 people. It was written by Mark Grenwald, who I'm a big fan of, Bill Matlow and Stephen Grant, with the script by Bill Matlow, and the pencils were John Romita Jr. And there, yep, it was Jim Shooter.
Yeah.
Editor-in-chief. The art is really nice. It's amazing how different Romita Jr.'s art style has changed over the years.
Yeah.
It was more of a George Perez style back then, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that'd be another reason to check it out. Well, I have one last thing I could talk about, unless you want to wrap up.
No, let's talk about that last thing and then wrap up.
Alright, so this is this connects back to the last episode also. I read To Save Mankind, They Became the Night Force. So I was pulled in by that preview that I talked about last time, and I went ahead and I picked up the full series. I only read so far 7.5 issues, and the reason I read half will become clear, but once again, this is by the same people that did the preview. It's Marv Wolfman, and art by Gene Colan, and if you might remember from last time, we have Baron Winters, who it's never explicitly spelled out, but he seems to be kind of he's a very eccentric guy, and there's a lot of strange indications and clues that he might be immortal or just have lived for a really long time. And he lives in this crazy mansion that with his pet tiger, Merlin. And every once in a while, when you the mansion almost seems to time travel. Sometimes when you open the door to his garden, it actually takes you to a different random spot in history. But as we saw in the 16-page preview, that he basically is recruiting what he calls his night force. And they are Jack Gold, who's a reporter for a tabloid, Donovan Kane, who's a professor at Georgetown, and Vanessa Van Helsing, who, when things start out as an insane asylum, later it's explained that she's, as her last name indicates, a descendant of the Van Helsing who is in the book Dracula, and that while Baron Winters doesn't know if Dracula actually existed, he knows that that Vanessa's ancestor, Van Helsing, existed, and that she's inherited psychic abilities that he has. And that's kind of, this storyline is hinged kind of around Vanessa and her psychic ability. She can tap into basically the, what is the primal force of evil. And Donovan Kane, he's working on this secret project for the government to use actual evil as a force of energy to tap that, harness it somehow, and use it as a weapon. And we saw in the preview that he's been doing these experiments, basically flirting with this evil force and Satanism, doing rituals. And these rituals have been activating, even though she's across town, she's been activating Vanessa's power and unknowingly creating these demonic forces and stuff that wreak havoc in the town. And Jack Gold is involved because he's a reporter and he's assigned to do a story on the happenings in this town. And basically, Vanessa ends up being taken out of the asylum by Jack Gold on Baron Winter's behalf. And Donovan Kane takes her to his lab so they can use her more directly, use her power to try to tap into demonic energies. And one of the themes throughout the story is people underestimating Vanessa's abilities. So they keep trying to use her to tap the forces of evil, but it always ends up backfiring. And Donovan takes Vanessa, and Baron Winters wants to warn Donovan that he should be more careful or something like that. And meanwhile, there's these agents from the Soviet Union that are wanting to get a hold of Vanessa for their own purposes. And so they cut the phone lines so that Winters and Jack Gold can't warn Donovan Kane. And his rituals get out of control. Vanessa subconsciously creates this huge demonic force that ends up pretty much vaporizing all of Kane's assistants and killing his wife. He's the only one that makes it out alive. And the Russians abduct Vanessa and take her to the Russian embassy in London. Meanwhile, a detective named Elliot Short starts investigating what's going on, starts looking into Baron Winters and the abduction of Vanessa and all this, you know, crazy demonic things that have been happening throughout the town as a result of these experiments and stuff. So while they're in Russia, while they're in the Russian embassy, Vanessa's experimented on by a German doctor who, you know, speaks with the real stereotypical German accent and stuff. And once again, he pushes her too far, and she ends up creating this huge fire that ends up, and the German doctor ends up getting killed in it. So they take her to, take her to Russia. And they take her up to Siberia, where there's this huge city basically they call it the Science City Complex, and they take her to Science City Complex number 5, and they give her to an old professor named Valdis, who seems pretty nice at first until he hooks her up to this contraption that comes out of a huge pentagram on the floor. And once she's hooked up, she realizes that he's, you know, obsessed with harnessing this power of evil that she can tap into. And for a third time, the extent of her power is underestimated, and she, because she's hooked up to this machine that's amplifying her powers, she pretty much gives in to the evil energy inside of her, and she creates this massive evil monster that's kind of a manifestation of all the anger inside of her and stuff, and it speaks with these crazy black letters and green word bubbles. And she creates all these pink snakes that are crawling all over the lab and everything like that. Meanwhile, Gold and Kane go to rescue her, and they're dropped off about 9 miles away from this complex and have to trudge through the snow, and they almost die before making it. There's a, basically they end up confronting the pink monster, this big pink monster, that's a manifestation of Vanessa. And she's accusing, Gold, because earlier on in the story, they, made love, and, so Vanessa's basically in love with Gold, and he secretly doesn't, you know, he likes her, but he's secretly not in love with her, but he tells the monster that he is so that she'll, you know, basically to get her powers under control and everything. He convinces her that he loves her. Detective Short, meanwhile, confronts Baron Winters, and Winters escapes by running into 14th century France when the Black Plague is going on. And Detective Short forces his men to follow after him into 14th century France, even though they're, you know, don't know what the hell's going on. So in the first issue, Marv Wolfman has this text piece in the back. It's kind of like a full page, and he talks about how, you know, he planned for the story to be a 7-issue story, but when you get to the end of issue 7, which is, you know, 1 through 7 is pretty much what I just summarized, there's a note from him saying that the story got a little longer than they expected. So issue 8, when I said I read 7.5 issues, issue 8 is actually half, first half finishes this storyline, and the second half starts a new one. The story kind of wraps up. We find out that Kane gets reunited with his son, who's been waiting. Winters takes Baron Winters has another assistant that turns out to be a guy actually from 18th century, looks like England. This guy from the 18th century takes responsibility for some of the stuff that is going on, gets arrested, but then disappears from the back of the police car. And Baron Winters basically leaves Vanessa with Gold, saying that they're going to get married. And, you know, his thought bubbles basically reveal that he doesn't really love her, but he's afraid of the force, you know, for getting out of control and her not being able to control it again if he tells her the truth. And kind of leaves it there. Another thing I found interesting, like I said, the first two issues both have a text piece from Wolfman where he talks about, you know, the history of horror comics and the 60s, Phantom Stranger and Swamp Thing, Werewolf by Night and Man Thing over at Marvel. And he talks about Tomb of Dracula, which is what he and Gene Colan worked on together before this. And thought it was kind of interesting because he talks about how it's they're expecting it to be an uphill battle in terms of sales, doing a horror book in this market, and also doing a a long form story. You know, and sure enough, at the end of at the back of issue 8, he says that he basically tells people straight out, you know, this new story that starts in the second half of 8 is only going to last till issue 10. And then they're going to do a bunch of one- and two-parters because even though they've gotten a lot of good mail reaction, sales haven't been very good. And sure enough, I haven't finished reading them yet, but issue 14 was the last issue of Night Force that did get canceled. Seems like at the time they were planning on doing a miniseries really soon, but I don't think it was till later on. I mentioned last time that they just wrapped up a current miniseries in the New 52, but I believe there was another one at some point too.
Yeah, 1996, there was a second one, around 12 issues.
Yeah, so it sounds like he was hopeful that they were going to be doing a miniseries really soon after. This was the 80s, the early 80s, but...
Yeah, I think I own these, but I've only read the first four.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot to... I was a little bit long-winded there trying to summarize 7.5 issues and be succinct about it, but I liked it. I mean, it definitely has a very creepy atmosphere.
It's well-written.
Yeah, the Gene Colan art is really good. His style is very appropriate to being on a horror book, and it's well-written. I mean, it's very... And Wolfman... can tend to be this way, and especially writing a horror comic, there's a lot of captions. It's very writerly, some of the sentences seem like almost adapted from prose, but it's good storytelling. It's definitely a good horror book, and I found it interesting also that one of the letters in one of the books asked why they weren't going direct sales with it to avoid the comic code, and he answered that because that was around this time becoming a new thing in the early 80s was when direct sales only books started showing up, and he said that they just chose not to because they wanted to reach as many people as possible. So
doesn't seem like it helped.
No, but it's definitely, I'd say it's, I mean, I got these issues. Most of them I got for 50 cents a piece, and I'm going to read the other ones probably for next time. But I definitely think they're worth going back to. I think they just did a trade because of the new miniseries.
Mm-hmm. If I can find them, I'll see if I can catch up to you and finish them. Finding them is going to be a bear, but I'll look for them.
Yeah, I think they're worth checking out. I enjoyed it. I felt that the preview was promising, and so I decided to pick these up, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah, and I like the new series too.
Yeah, I know. I want to, like I said, I had started reading it, and I have all 7 issues now. So I think once I finish up reading this this old one, the rest of these, I'm going to go ahead and read the new one back to back to kind of compare.
Yeah, I think it would read better if you read them in one sitting, because monthly it kind of drags out in the middle.
Yeah, and I read the first few on a monthly basis as I was getting them, and I wasn't following as well as I would like, and that's why I stopped. I just started collecting them together.
Yeah.
Figured I'd wait.
I don't know how it wraps up because I haven't read 7 yet, but. That's the only one. That's the last of the series, ironically, because you said the first series was supposed to be 7 issues. Well, this one, the new one, is 7 issues.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't think it sold very good, so it might be All We See of the Night Force for a while. It almost feels like a favor they did to Marv Wolfman or something.
Yeah, it's just... I just don't understand why, cool B-list and C-list things can't take off. Like, people don't want to try new stuff, or would they rather just stick with Batman? Or
Yeah, it's also, like, it didn't sell well for DC, but you know, it would be cool if it's a cool concept, and it definitely is. You know, it's one of the things that he talks about in the text piece at the back of the first issue of the of this 1980s series is how, you know, one of the things that they're trying with it is that they're going to keep Baron Winters as the primary centralized figure. But as far as, you know, he said, one of the things that we really want to do here is when it comes to the actual members of the Night Force, you don't know who's going to survive. You know, it's possible that people will die. And nobody, none of the three of them die in here, but Donovan Cain ends up losing both a leg and an arm. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of retired. But, and I haven't read them, but just from hearing you talked about, like, Avatar's crossed psychopath, it reminded me of that concept of, you know, that was one of the things that you expressed that you liked about it was that you never know who's going to last because it doesn't maintain the same character. So that's kind of what he was going for here. So it's definitely a concept that has longevity. It's almost like you think you'd be better off seeing if you can get the concept from DC and taking it to a smaller publisher that wouldn't need it to sell as much, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it's a cool concept. I think that's why they keep trying it. But
well, they do have a diverse line right now in the New 52, which is kind of cool. Like, you can read horror like I Vampire and Night Force mm-hmm. and Justice League, and then the mystical like Justice League Dark and, you know, Swamp Thing and Animal Man, and that are not quite mainstream superheroes. And you got the Western stuff, and you got the war books that they keep trying, but they just can't take off. But they're it's not because they're not good books. It just it's just the genre has a hard time too.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's been one good thing about the New 52 so far is that, you know, they're shooting for a more diverse lineup, at least compared to what them and Marvel normally do
mm-hmm.
or have done in recent years. You know, and it's cool to see other genres supported because I definitely like to read a variety. I like my superheroes, but I like to have a mix of different stuff.
Yeah, me too.
So, well, you want to wrap this up?
Yeah, I think I want to dive into Phantom Stranger next time. Because I'm liking the New 52 Phantom Stranger.
Yeah, I read the Zero issues. I just got my stuff. I haven't really read anything from this.
Did you order number one?
Yeah, I do have number one here.
Oh, I think you'll like it, especially because you're a Titans guy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I ordered the first few issues of this most recent wave of stuff because they all sounded like they had potential. There's been some that I've passed on in other waves, but see how they go. Try a few issues and see how I like them.
Mm-hmm.
So,
all right, let's wrap this guy up. You've just heard Geek Brunch Retrocast number 2. You can get a hold of us on Twitter, Myth Making ETC, etc.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
on Twitter and Mike Myers Brunch, and our Facebook page. You could go into the search area and type Geek Brunch podcast, and you'll find us there. We're at Forum for Geeks. And if you scroll down the Geek Brunch, we have episode posts on there. We should probably put like a Q&A thing out there too. I did put you in for an admin, but I haven't gotten a response back yet.
Okay. So, yeah, I saw that that I have access to the Facebook page and people want to email us. You're Mike at Comic Book Noise, right?
Yeah.
And I am MythMaking. etc@gmail.com, MythMaking, etc. I figure I'd name myself something that required an explanation every time. Yeah, I didn't really think about that, but and just a technical note. I did I bought Pretty May this morning, but I'm still waiting for the license key to take it out of trial mode, so I only recorded the first half hour, but. By next time, they're supposed to get the email within the first 12 hours or something like that to the license key, so next time I should have be able to do a full recording.
Right. And we can leave an iTunes review. You could leave it under Geek Brunch, since they're all being released under that same RSS feed. Just say you're leaving a comment for Retrocast, and be the first to leave an iTunes review for Retrocast.
Yeah, that distinguishment is still available.
Yeah. And if you guys have questions, or a couple of you have told us you want us to cover some books, like we had some requests for the Invaders and Doom Patrol, and I can't remember what the other one was, but it didn't fall in the ten year window. It was a Batman Monster Man or something like that.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we'll, but by the time we get to it, it'll probably be 10. It's just like 2 years off, so we'll get to it eventually.
We'll put it on the queue for, you know, episode 50-something.
That's right.
But, the Invaders, that reminds me, I wrote myself a note here to check to see, because if there's some of those issues on the Digital Unlimited, I might check some of those out for next time.
Yeah, I wish there was more old stuff on Comixology, because it's just easy.
Mm-hmm.
If I want to check something out, or if I missed an issue, just to go get it rather than the long box thing. That's the one superpower I wish I had. I wish I had if I had comic collecting powers, I wish I could like magically sort and box and put these in logical order easy.
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be a good convenient one.
And then the other one I'd really wish I could do is like port them away when I want to port them away and have the room, and then bring them in whenever I need the room.
Yeah, you need like a dimensional, like a small little pocket dimension for your comic.
A boom tube.
Yeah.
I hit the boom tube with a little mother box on my shoulder here, and could boom tube them away. And then when I want to go get them, I'll just boom tube over there and go grab them.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Yeah, it would be pretty nice. I'm so far behind on bagging and boarding. If I could just point at my boxes and have them instantaneously all done, be awesome.
I enjoy it, but there's just not enough time. It's like if I want to devote a whole weekend, that's a whole weekend of non-reading. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like I'm bagging and boarding, and I never get a day off from work. If I had a day off from work, then I could sit down and bag and board as I like watch TV or something. But
yeah, honestly, that's the only time I ever do it is while I watch TV. Number one, because it's accomplishing two things at once, and then also because, you know, it gets a little boring.
Yeah.
But I don't know, people talk about it's not worth it, and you know, I just, for some reason, I just like filing them that way. I like filing them in bags, and I like the way that comics, I like the way the covers look when they're in a...
Oh, yeah, they look, it looks awesome. I mean, it keeps them in good, pristine condition, and it looks cool. The thing I really struggle with is I have like five piles, well, no, maybe it's three piles of books. Like I have one that I like did a massive sort on, but it's not easy to resort back in just because of the sheer quantity of books I buy. Because then I have to have like seven empty boxes and then rotate them in, and it just gets confusing. It gets hard. If I had somebody to do that for me, it'd be awesome.
Yeah.
And if I'm trying to get all short boxes, like the drawer boxes, so they're easy to get to.
Yeah.
But I still have quite a bit of my collection in the old style boxes, which are a little harder. They're stackable, but you have to pick them up and to get to them.
Yeah, I did that a little bit ago. I used short boxes, and I need some more now, but I did get a whole bunch of drawer boxes, and I hesitated for a while pulling the trigger on buying them. But once I got them and set them up, I lost all hesitation. Just, they're just so awesome to have.
And they're so easy to get to. Like once I know where things are, if I need to get to a book, I just pull it out. You know, I just like a drawer, and I can get to it.
I do not miss.
I have a mixed mode of collection.
Yeah, I definitely don't miss find, like, you know, going through a stack of boxes and picking them up, putting them down. It's just being able to walk over and just pull out a drawer is really awesome.
Yeah.
But it's easy for me to say because I have, like, my collection is like 10% of yours. So it's a little bit easier for me to convert.
Yeah.
If
I had a couple months sabbatical or something, I would love to get it all straightened out. My wife would love it too if it was all straightened out.
Yeah, you need to train Harley.
Yeah.
To be a comic book sorter.
Look, she's not a comic book destroyer, at least.
Yeah.
So
that's the important thing.
Yeah. Well, so. You have a good week. You have a couple days off, right?
Yep. We're going to go to a musical tonight, actually, which is something I do like maybe once a year. My parents do like a season pass, and every once in a while they can get tickets sort of near their seats. So we're going to see Jekyll and Hyde.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I figured I'd pick something that the only other time I went was when they did Young Frankenstein. So I usually try to pick something. I'm not a huge musical fan, so but it's a fun experience regardless.
And I've only seen like Dracula and a couple other the horror themed musicals.
Yeah,
they're enjoyable.
But yeah, it's a fun time, you know, to do once a year.
Young Frankenstein would be great because I just love that movie. The movie's fantastic.
Yeah, that's why I thought it would be cool to check it out. It was pretty good, you know. They kept a lot of the nature of the humor stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, cool.
Well, have a good one.
All right, thanks.
Go Bills.
You too. Yeah. Go Bills.
All right, talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
There's power in numbers. Nintendo, now you're playing with power. Each game sold separately.